Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Interim Committee on Health Care to order. It is Wednesday, November 18th. It's actually my daughter's birthday, 32 years ago. Anyway, we have a very, I think, full agenda and very interesting agenda today. And with that, I'd like to welcome Senator Morissette here. And I know Senator Cruz is here and will be here shortly. I think Senator Bates is just getting back from his honeymoon, so I don't think he's going to be here. He's on the plane, so he won't be here. And then Senator Morse, I think, is out of state also. So, with that, I would like to welcome the representatives from the Oregon National Primate Research Center at Oregon Health and Science University.
Okay, great. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susie Funkhauser, Government Relations for OHSU, and I am just here to mostly answer questions and introduce Dr. Nancy Hagwood, who is the director of the Oregon National Primate Research Center.
Thank you, and good morning.
Is the mic on?
Yeah, it seems like it's a little...
Okay.
Seems kind of low.
It's low, I can't...
Yeah. We have to speak loudly.
I'll be happy to.
Very good.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Mona Sanderson, and members of the committee. Thank you very much for welcoming us here. And I come here, as Susie said, as a researcher and the current director of the Oregon National Primate Research Center. I've been involved in non-human primate research for all of my 30 years of my career since getting my PhD, and presently currently do AIDS research, as for the list.
Is that your phone? If we can turn the phone off.
That's very melodic.
It's my mistake. I'm not turning it off. I'm so sorry. The slides that I brought to you are short and to the point. I just want to spend a little bit of time helping you understand the background of the Primate Center and provide some background for some questions if you'd like. This first slide emphasizes that the Oregon Center is one of the 8 National Primate Research Centers, and as you can see, they're located throughout the country, originally regional centers, and have now become national resources, and our goals are the breeding, housing, and research in non-human primate models. We serve as research institutes, not just breeding places, and I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about that. Our mission in the second slide is to use scientific discovery, and in particular non-human primate models, to accelerate the progress, and we do this through conducting state-of-the-art research, providing this resource that I mentioned previously of the non-human primates, and at that same time we provide the highest level of care, humane care, for our animals. And we're also a training institution for medical fellows and veterinary fellows and graduate students and postdoctoral fellows, as well as through an outreach program that I'll describe to you in a moment. Our organization this year has a budget of about $37 million. Just a rough idea to give you a breakdown of our budget. About half of our budget is what we call investigator-initiated grants. These are grants written by individual researchers to study particular problems that will advance human health, and that's the green section. And we are also funded by the National Institutes of Health in the orange sector. That's our so-called base grant that helps us provide infrastructure for breeding and care of our animals. And the other two segments, the blue, is foundation grants, such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And in yellow, we do some industry work. So we invite companies to work with us if there's a good match between what their interests are and what our expertise is.
Oh, just a question on the industry. Is that research industries, or is it, could you give an example?
Yes, there are a couple of biotech companies that have come to us, as well as large pharma also does some experiments with us. An example would be work in reproductive science to test compounds that might facilitate better ovulation or a contraception.
Oh.
That would be an example. The good news is that despite the economic downturn, we've had really good economic times at our center, and that is because mostly our funding does come from the U.S. government, and it is, again, investigator-initiated, and we've been successful in part because of the good ideas of our investigators, but also in part because of the stimulus funding, which we call ERA funding, and I'll summarize that in just a moment. So you can see our annual growth has been about 10% in the last year, a little better than average.
Better than the state.
Sorry, I meant to move this forward. Excuse me. So just to give you a sense for what we've been doing this spring, we've been very, very busy applying for funding through the ERA opportunities, including $39 million of applications, and they're broken into these kinds of grants. This is how we get construction funds to help us build additional research space as well as additional breeding space for our animals. We have been successful so far in obtaining $7.5 million, and we're very hopeful on another construction grant that got a good score. That's a $15 million grant. We've also continued to apply for regular research grants, and that's about $32 million. That's rather typical of what we would do. The things that we study, I've summarized some of the major areas that are studied in non-human primate models. These models were originally used to look at non-human primate behavior and have grown into disease models over the years, as we've discovered, because of their genetic similarity to humans and the opportunity to use not only infectious disease like AIDS and hepatitis, malaria, and some of these other diseases, but also they're very good models for brain biology, and we have currently an active neuroscience program that looks into...
Okay, just 1 second.
They did adjust the volume, so now you have to sit up. That crackling is from not being too close, sorry.
Excuse me.
Yeah, you're fine right there.
I'm causing all kinds of sound problems.
Yeah, and Senator Morissette.
What about stem cell research? Are you doing any of that with, say, Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or...
Yes, sir. We are doing stem cell research. It has not progressed quite yet to studying Parkinson's, but that is one of our goals at our center. We have a very active stem cell program, and it is one of our main features. We published a paper this past year that showed that we could replace the mitochondrial genes that were diseased in one animal with the genes from another animal by doing replacement of the nucleus of an egg into a fresh cell that has good genes, if you will, and that was then gestated into live monkeys. We have 3 monkeys that were generated this way. So the potential application would be any of these diseases, including Parkinson's.
Mm-hmm. One of the companies, and I forget which one, has been approved. They've done the research on animals, and that's been approved for humans. I forget the name of the company, but you're working with a particular company on stem cell?
Our research for stem cells is primarily funded by National Institutes of Health, and we are not working with companies right now These monkeys, the monkey research is, of course, easier to do in the sense that it can be funded by NIH funding.
Yeah.
And we can do more risky experiments than, in my opinion, ought to be done in humans before they've been shown to work in animal models.
Well, that's really exciting because that will be a major breakthrough in some of these areas that you're looking at. So that's very exciting.
We're hopeful we can make a dent in diabetes also by this way. So some of the other areas.
Thank you.
Just to comment on how many animals we're talking about, we have about 4,400 non-human primates, or monkeys. We call them non-human primates, and these consist primarily of rhesus macaques, which you're probably quite familiar with, a beautiful animal, a Japanese macaque, and various other species, small numbers of these. About 90% of the animals are the rhesus macaque, and we have a few other animals pictured at the bottom that are part of basic research. Importantly, our research is very highly regulated. I know you all are very familiar with these rules, but just to emphasize, we are overseen by at least 3 different national organizations, NIH, the USDA, and the Office of Laboratory Animal Welfare, or OLAW, as we call that. And we also are one of those centers that has the gold seal of approval from what's called ALAC, American Association for Accreditation of Laboratory Animal Care. This requires a higher standard than is attained by all institutions. We're very proud. We've had this approval for more than 25 years. Importantly, every single experiment that is done by every investigator must be approved by a local committee. That's called the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee. So these are examples of the oversight that we obtain. And We are pleased to share our results with the public. We publish our results in peer-reviewed journals, and this means that the research that we're doing is getting a lot of scrutiny before we do it, after we do it, and that therefore we believe we can build upon the work of others and advance biomedical research in this way.
Yes.
I'm interested in some follow-up information regarding the stem cell research, and if you could get something to the committee chair and administrator to distribute to us, I would appreciate it.
Yes,
because I think that is a very important area, and I'm really interested in the progress and so on.
I'd be very pleased to offer that information to you. I can do that in the next few days.
Thank you.
Part of what we do to manage our animals is carefully care for them, but in addition, we increase opportunities for natural behaviors. You can see in this photograph one of our outdoor corrals where animals are allowed to be raised from birth through the time that they're assigned to experiments. And many animals remain simply in the breeding colony, and they can perform their natural social behaviors, which include foraging and explorations. We also, animals that are kept indoors or partially indoors, have opportunities to go outside and, again, to be with other animals. And this provides not only enrichment for them, but it reduces stress for them, and this makes a happier monkey is a better participant in
Madam
research.
Chair, speaking of happy monkeys,
yes, sir.
What do you do when they retire? I was listening to an NPR program one time about the monkeys that are in research, and when they leave, they go into a retirement situation. Are you involved in any of that?
We have some of the oldest rhesus macaques and Japanese macaques in captivity at our center. In fact, we actually study aging. It's one of our main
focus. Okay, They don't leave and go somewhere else for their happy retirement.
they don't. The animals that do that primarily are chimpanzees and
chimpanzees.
Other apes.
Okay.
We have no chimpanzees or apes on
there
our
was a chimpanzee
at this time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I can say, though, that the natural lifetime life expectancy of the animals in our care is about double what it would be in nature because, of course, there are no predators. So.
Except the people who take care of them, maybe.
We like to think of ourselves as partners.
Sorry about that.
So I'd just like to end on a couple of slides. One is to emphasize the strengths of our center. We are 50 years old as of this year, and we are pleased to have a strong scientific growth and opportunities for research. The number of employees at our centers is about 488. We have most of those people are at the primate center, and there are a few, these sister institute, the Vaccine and Gene Therapy Institute, but at our campus there are about 480 some investigators working in this area. That includes about 125 to 130 animal care workers, and a lot of these are new employees who we've been able to add as part of the ERA funding. It's a beautiful campus, and if you ever get a chance to visit us, we'd be delighted to show you around. It's about 160 acres. We have a regional center for excellence. This is a grant that studies bioterrorism and provides vaccines that can limit the development of such bioterrorist weapons potentially in the future, and works on diseases that are outbreak diseases like West Nile virus.
And where is it located, the campus?
It's on the border of Beaverton and Hillsborough. It's on 185th Avenue in Beaverton. That's the address.
Okay.
And we back up into the Kotama area, if you're at all familiar with Hillsborough.
No.
It's a lovely campus.
Yeah, okay. Good. Thank you.
I want to emphasize that our primate models are designed to enhance translational research, and by that I mean the very thing that President Obama is emphasizing, which is research that is taken from the bench to the bedside, the laboratory bench, to getting into the clinic requires intermediate analysis and often proof of principle that can show whether an idea is a good idea or not. Mm-hmm. And without that information, it's much more risky to do clinical research. So we, not in every case, but in many diseases, it's a great opportunity to test the idea before things can move forward to humans. And we partner with our colleagues up on the hill, as we call it, at OHSU, at the medical school, the dental school, and the other professional schools up there to do this research. We also partner with a lot of people throughout the country because we're a national resource. And we do have a very active educational outreach program that reaches out to teachers in high school, middle school, and students at various levels. And we have community volunteers who work with us. We're very interested in increasing our community involvement because we know from research and from our own experience that the more people know about us, the better they'll understand the important link that we have to helping biomedical research. So we want to enhance this work.
Madam Chair, what do visitors, if we visited the campus, what kind of a tour would we have, or what would be your procedure?
Visitors are typically welcomed in our auditorium and then taken on a walking tour that shows the laboratory buildings from the outside and then our outdoor corrals and our outdoor what we call sheltered housing. There are opportunities to see monkeys together in groups that are simply growing up, mm-hmm. eating, playing. So you would see about 3,000 of our animals.
Ooh,
if you came.
Wow. You have that many? 3,000?
4,400.
4,400. Okay.
I want to end on the note of researcher safety. This is the reason that we're here today, because we are cognizant of the fact that due to our research and due to the activism that exists in the United States and worldwide, we are sometimes the target of such organizations. And it's important to us that we can be able to continue to attract the best researchers to our facility. And we know from discussing this with our researchers how much they appreciate what the legislature has done for us. And I want to go on record thanking you for what you have done to allow us to redact names, for example, from some of our protocols when we are asked to provide information under the Freedom of Information Act. This is very important to us because we can't encourage people to come and work with us if they don't feel safe. Many of our investigators, unfortunately, have had home visits and vandalism at their homes, and we would like to keep it, make it difficult for them to know exactly what we are doing on a day-to-day basis. While we absolutely want people to understand what the goals of our research are, what the outcomes of our research are, and that we are highly regulated and that we are taking care of our animals. We would like you to continue to play this role in the continued protection of our researchers, and we want to work in partnership with you to figure out the best way to do that. We would like to, engage in a discussion with you to see how this might best go forward.
Great concern about the safety of the employees, because I know, having been a research biologist for just a very small portion of my life before I became a nurse, is that research is vital to saving lives and taking care of having inroads into disease and in particular. So I think we have to stay on top of this. I think that I know that their cruelty to animals is just crime, but if you've ever worked in a research lab, it's not like that at all. It's very, very regulated. So I do have a concern, and I think you need to come to us if there are problems in your industry. And Senator Morissette.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really interested in the models or the infectious diseases that you have listed, all of these areas. And do you have, progress reports on any of this? Like, for instance, Hep C, where are you in dealing with hepatitis C? That's something that we have been interested in committee.
Our center has a very active research in AIDS vaccines. Mm-hmm. We don't have anyone doing hepatitis C vaccines at the moment, but I'm very familiar with this because I have several friends and collaborators who do work on hepatitis C vaccines.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is if you have an overview of each of these areas and what it is you're doing in the areas, what progress. I'm not asking that you create something, but if you happen to have something that you can share with us in terms of the progress, what your hopes are in these areas and where you are in your research and so on, that would be really good information to have.
Or even links to the publications that are dealing with the research.
One resource that we do have, and I apologize, I should have put this on the slide, is our website, which is freely available and contains specific examples of publications and current activities in the areas, the key areas.
Oh, that's
research.
Great. Yeah.
And that would include reproductive science, neuroscience, and infectious disease, aging, stem cell research. So, and we also work on obesity, which is a great interest in the United States today, excuse me, because it leads to type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And each of those areas, there's detailed information on our website about what we're doing. And I would be, again, if you have additional questions about some of these other areas, I'd be happy to fill in the gaps.
Well, if you could get the website information to our administrator, that would be good.
Because we have had people, especially in your committee, where we were always trying to get funding for hepatitis C.
You're right.
And it's sort of nice to know the research that's going on in that area. And I know that CDC has come up with some ERA money, I think, for obesity. So I don't know if you apply for that or if that's more for community-based research or programs.
The ERA funding that we've gotten so far for research has been targeted towards neuroscience and targeting the brain in an effort to silence certain genes in the brain for one of the major diseases, and it's escaping me at the moment. I apologize. One of the genetic diseases, though, that causes very severe developmental problems. But we do have quite a lot of NIH funding for the study of obesity. We have a group of animals that have been fed the typical American diet, which is 30% fat. And they gain up to 50 to 100% of their weight in a very short period of time. What's interesting about those animals is they do go on to develop type 2 diabetes, but not every animal does. So that's that's another clue that perhaps there's a genetic component. The reason we don't do hepatitis C research at the Oregon Center is because the model for hepatitis C is the chimpanzee, and we have no chimpanzees. But again, I can tell you how the research is going there. There's some very exciting results.
One other quick question. Do you stimulate stem cell production from the bone marrow to use the natural stem cells that the bone marrow produces to heal? I guess theoretically you could, you can, if you can get those stem cells to act the way they're supposed to or and so on, you can do all kinds of good things. So is that part of your research? I guess maybe that's on your website.
It is on the website. The main foci of the stem cell research are to study the egg of the non-human primate and to use that cell as, I mean, that's a stem cell in itself, and to use that information in the non-human primate egg. What our investigator, Dr. Metallopoulos, has been able to do is to show that you can take the genes from an egg and put that into even a skin cell and make that into a pluripotent or a stem cell for another type of cell. So his focus is working with the eggs that are stimulated from the stimulated female animal, not so much the bone marrow at this time.
Okay. Yeah, it's all very, very fascinating.
Is there research at all on any of our mental health diseases or disorders, I guess is what you would call them, at all? Do primates have mental health disorders like we do? I know they have depression. I don't know if they have bipolar or schizophrenia or any of those.
We do have efforts to understand their cognitive development It's certainly outside my area of expertise because I work on infectious disease. Typically, though, we work on some of their behaviors, such as aggression or fear, more than things that require cognitive measurements in our center. One of the other centers, the Yerkes Center, has a very active program in cognitive development. Hmm. And we work together as a consortium, the eight centers, so I'm a little familiar with some of the research, but I would say it's not a major thrust of our area.
But if we went on the website, would we be able to?
You would find our center and links to all of the other centers.
And if we put a search in on, say, brain for one, and then see what comes up?
I think so.
Okay.
I haven't done it myself recently.
Yeah.
That's our goal.
Yeah.
Well, you do brain biology.
Yeah, right.
Brain biology is listed here.
One of the areas we work in is macular degeneration, and that's an excellent model. And there's some very encouraging results where the macaques have been shown to have exactly the same gene involved in macular degeneration as has been shown for the human defect, suggesting strongly that they're an excellent model. And we're in the process of working on potentially stem cell approaches to correct that.
Wow.
So there's an area.
When there's research, especially I'm thinking of all the various cancers, and in the research lab they find something that might stem the tide of cancer. Are those then products sent to you and you test them on the animals?
I think you've got me in the one area that we don't work, which is cancer.
Okay.
Cancer is relatively rare in the non-human primate models, and we're not sure why.
Hmm.
Could be lifestyle. Could be we don't have enough aged animals to start to see it. But we really don't do cancer research.
Interesting.
The only exception to that so far is there's a disease called Kaposi's sarcoma, which is associated. It's an AIDS-associated malignancy, and that is seen in the macaques primarily because it seems to be caused by a virus.
Mm-hmm.
So we can model that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a rare case of a cancer that we can study so far.
So cancer isn't in the primate?
Not typically. I can't think of a good example. We are building models for other diseases and that have come out recently. Heart disease is an excellent model. Things that stem from the obesity, we are just beginning to see some of those. And it's possible that cancer will also arise as we study more animals. But that research is that's not a longevity. It's only about 5 years along. So we're keeping our eyes open.
Wonderful.
None of these primates smoke, though, right?
They don't. One of our investigators does study the effects of nicotine, though.
Of what?
They study the effects of nicotine, especially on premature birth. And there are major effects of nicotine on causing potentially premature birth.
Yeah, we had three children born prematurely when my wife was smoking, and she quit smoking, and the rest of them were born. That is a given.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sorry to hear that. I'm glad to know that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Just keep us apprised, I think, if there are issues that we need to take a look at.
I'd like to leave you with my card, if I may, and it has the website on that.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And we will follow up with more information on our research.
Appreciate it. Yeah. All right. With that, I'll close that informational hearing, and let's open up informational hearing on environmental health in the Columbia Gorge.
He said we don't monkey around here. So.
Committee, when we were last meeting that we had air quality, a report on air quality, and the Columbia Gorge said that they had some information that they would like to share with us. And so I thought if they could just take a few moments to share about our beautiful area up where I live.
That's where ice is over. And
thank you, Madam Chair. I have a
thank goodness for the east wind now.
We'll talk a little bit about the wind and what's in the wind. You just give me a moment while I cue this up.
I think the Columbia River Gorge is one of the most beautiful areas in the world.
Well, somewhat behind the North Umpqua River, but that's okay.
Well, I was going to mention the Mackenzie River area myself.
Well, North Umpqua, you end up at Crater Lake, for gosh sake.
Oh, well, now, right. Yes, Crater Lake is another beautiful icon in this area, in this state.
To floors.
Is that your district?
No, it's in Whitsitt's district. It's always made me right. Mad.
For tomorrow. Oh, there we go.
What do you mean for tomorrow?
They had me worried there for a minute.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Lang. I'm Conservation Director for Friends of the Columbia Gorge. Really appreciate the opportunity to come before you for a few moments today and talk about environmental health, particularly as it relates to air quality in the Columbia River Gorge. Just a little preface about what I know and what I don't know. Our organization works to protect the scenic, natural, cultural, and recreation resources of the Columbia River Gorge. My talk today will not focus so much on the human health impacts of air pollution in the Columbia River Gorge, more on the general environmental impacts. Of course, there are human health impacts associated with air pollution in the Columbia River Gorge as well. So I hope my remarks help build a general pool of knowledge about air pollution in the region. Certainly the Columbia River Gorge is very important to the quality of life of everybody in the region, Portland, Vancouver area, and then the entire state.
Just move the microphone just an inch back.
Too loud?
No, when the crackling comes, yeah. Just no, it's not too loud.
Okay. So the remarks I'll make today really focus on the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. This federal law was passed in 1986. Our organization, Friends of the Columbia Gorge, was formed in 1980 to pass federal legislation to protect this bi-state region under an umbrella of federal law, but also implemented in the states of Oregon and Washington through an interstate compact. Just quickly, the purposes and standards of the Act to protect the scenic, natural, cultural, and recreation resources of the Gorge and to support the economies of the Gorge urban areas. Briefly, the boundaries and jurisdictions of the Gorge. The National Scenic Area begins at the Sandy River in Multnomah County, and then in Oregon it extends out to the middle of the Deschutes River. In Washington State, the boundaries start at the east end of the town of Washougal at Steigerwald National Wildlife Refuge, and over on the east end extend almost to Maryhill Museum, if you know where that is. And then there are 13 towns in the Gorge designated as urban areas where the federal law seeks to direct economic development. The National Scenic Area Act requires a protection of air quality, and the management plan, the umbrella planning document that extends over the bi-state region, requires protection and enhancement of air quality. In 2000, the Gorge Commission and Forest Service adopted new rules in the Gorge-wide management plan that require the protection and enhancement of air quality and visibility, and also require state agencies in Oregon, the DEQ, to adopt a comprehensive air quality strategy for the Gorge, with the goal being to protect and enhance air quality and visibility. This strategy has not yet been finalized or adopted by the state agencies. A little bit, just an overview.
So go back to that again, then.
Okay, let me see how I go back. There we go.
So you're saying that DEQ was supposed to adopt an air quality strategy, and 9 years later there's still no strategy?
That's correct. The Gorge Commission's management plan language that it adopted, which becomes by state law, and applies to state agencies in Oregon and Washington, required those agencies to work in concert and adopt an air quality strategy to present it to the Gorge Commission for formal adoption. And we had advocated for a timeline for the adoption of that strategy when rulemaking occurred. The Gorge Commission felt confident the agencies would have it in 3 years. It hasn't been done 9 years later, and there's still no timeline for adoption of a formal strategy.
So, Rick, could we just let the DEQ know this? I'd like to have a response from them regarding their views on this. Thanks.
You're welcome. An overview of air quality impacts. Several studies have occurred in the last 10 years indicating severe acid deposition in the Eastern Gorge. Pollution, clouds views 95% of the time in the National Scenic Area, and pollution has caused documented ecosystem change. In 1999, the Forest Service Region 6 Air Quality Management Team issued a report finding that visibility is impaired. This is through 5 or 6 years of air quality monitoring in the gorge. Also, a study, really fascinating, I think, on studying lichens in the gorge, which are sort of a canary in a coal mine, except in the lichen world, indicating high concentrations of pollution and an increased occurrence of pollution-resistant lichens that are non-native to the gorge. And native lichens are on the decline and much, much harder to find, those that are sensitive to sulfates and nitrates in particular. I have a few slides here just showing visibility. This is out in Wishram in the Eastern Gorge in the Washington side. It takes it's at an improved site, which is a federally funded monitoring site for air quality. This is measuring PM 2.5 particles. That's particles less than 2.5 microns that impede visibility and also result in human health impacts. This has a 3.6 microgram per cubic meter concentration. This is a pretty good air quality day. 79% of days are worse than this. Here is a PM 2.5 concentration of 6.8 micrograms per cubic meter. This, I chose this slide because 50% of days are better, 50% are worse. You can see some of the details in the landscape are getting, we're losing them because of haze.
And then, how do you determine the chemicals that you're measuring there, the products that you're measuring? Who measures that?
Well, the Forest Service measures it, and I'm not an air quality scientist, so I apologize. I can't go into the exact technology that they use at the improved site to determine the concentration. This is PM 2.5 of 14.7 micrograms per cubic meter. As you can see, you can no longer see Mount Hood or the more distant or mid-ground details in the gorge. 17% of days are worse than this day. And just as a measure, we're looking at visibility impacts here. The human health standard for 24 hours is 35 micrograms per cubic meter. That was just lowered 3 years ago from 65, which you probably couldn't see your hand in front of your face, was the federal standard. Mm. This will probably be lowered yet again within the next couple of years by the EPA. A study by Dr. Mark Fenn conducted in 2005 took a look at fog water deposition in the Eastern Gorge. And the concern was that because of sources east of the gorge, there was a high acid content in fog water, basically what we generally refer to as acid rain. The more technical term is acid deposition. What was found is that ammonium and nitrate deposition range from 11.5 to 25.4 kilograms per hectare over a 4.5 month study period. Deposition rates of nitrogen above 3 to 5 kilograms per hectare per year are harmful to ecosystems. The conclusion of this report is that ecosystem harm is certain in the gorge due to basically acid rain. A haze gradient study followed that. Dr. Mark Green and his colleagues from Desert Research conducted it. It identified the worst haze occurs in the winter downgorge easterly airflows. I'll talk more about that in a moment. Sources east of the gorge would be mainly responsible for those events. A cause of haze in the gorge, or the COHAGO report, was conducted also in 2006. It was a comprehensive look at air quality and visibility impacts in the gorge. What it identified was that wintertime haze is worse than summertime haze, with nitrates, sulfates, and organic carbon as the most dominant pollutants. The Portland metropolitan area contributes significantly to gorge air pollution during the summer when the airflows are reversed and you have an upgorge wind. Summertime haze mainly comes from organics, carbon, sulfate. Sulfate comes from sources including oil combustion, shipping, the shipyards, and paper mills. This is a graph of wind occurrence in the Columbia River Gorge. In the summertime, as you well know, the winds blow up the gorge. That's why it's one of the best places in the world to windsurf. In the winter, they're reversed, and we get a down gorge effect. Really, in the eastern gorge, it's more of a stagnant air mass. And because of the pressure difference, the low in the west, the high in the east, you get winds gaining velocity as they come down the gorge and bringing with it any pollutants that may be within it. The chemical composition of, again, this is PM2.5 particles in the summer. When the winds are from the west, this is a summertime graph, we see organic carbon, that's the green. Also, sulfates are relatively dominant on the west end of the gorge. In the wintertime, and I'm skipping over the other seasons because this shows a dramatic change, east winds are more prevalent. You have high nitrates and sulfates in the eastern gorge, and those contribute to visibility impairment and acid deposition. The PM2.5 mass at Mount Zion is a spot in the western gorge on the Washington side. And this is just a breakdown of the types of PM2.5 pollution. Biomass smoke is a big contributor. Also, sulfate secondary sources. They were able to draw out a signature from the paper mills of sulfur pollution, too, and draw that out, 14% coming from paper mills. And then at the east end, at the Wishram Improved site, we see more of a nitrate signature in the pollution, and sulfate, biomass smoke, and carbon are certainly a big factor as well, but a different signature indicating different sources of pollution, quite possibly power plants and agricultural sources in the east end of the gorge. Who is polluting the Columbia River Gorge? Dr. Dan Jaffe from University of Washington and also the Northwest Air Quality Institute took a look at what the likely sources, or the area from which the likely sources of pollution came from. And what he determined is that the worst air quality days in the gorge are during the fall and winter. And it's quite likely that the source come from power plants, that'd be PGE Boardman, and large CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations that are east of the Columbia River Gorge.
I know that there's talk about research with these feedlots sort of trying to use their energy to produce methane gas, yeah. Is that part of the...
There's a small project at Three Mile Canyon Farms, which is the largest CAFO in the region, and one of the largest in the United States. It's in the area of Boardman, and they are experimenting with a methane digester, I believe, at this time.
That's what I
think
about.
It produces a very small amount of energy. It's sort of a pilot project. That CAFO has a permit for 93,000 dairy cattle, and there are also feedlots there, so based on their reports, I think you'll see an additional 28,000 cattle and feedlots at that area. So a combined total with what they have at the dairies, around 57,000 cattle, about 100,000 cattle in that one spot.
Senator Morissette.
Certainly a lot of methane coming from the manure.
Well, we can't do away with power plants. We can't do away with feedlots. But if we can take a look at...
Absolutely.
The problems and see and incentivize research into taking care of some of these pollutants.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tillamook moved part of their operation from the coast because they were having some problems with water, you know, pollution with their cows and so on. And now, how large is their operation in Boardman? Is that are they the largest dairy that back there?
My understanding is that's correct.
Cheese factory.
Senator Morris said yes, it's the largest in the region and one of the largest in the country. But although they have a permit for 93,000 dairy cattle, I don't think they're at their permit level. I think they're down below 60,000. But that's a lot of dairy cattle, and that's not counting the feedlots.
Now, in following up on the other question, is there additional research on how to mitigate the damage, the harm that the feedlots are causing? Is that high on the list of things to do?
It was addressed by this body two sessions ago. There was a bill to try to regulate CAFOs in the state of Oregon, and as it made its way through the process, it resulted in a task force in late 2007 and 2008 that came up with some recommendations to bring back to this body. And what they were advocating for is implementation of best management practices to reduce the amount of methane going into the atmosphere. There are other states that do this. Idaho, for example, does have state law that requires best management practices in CAFOs, and I think it's defined to be above 750 animals. Not sure. Other states, Minnesota, for example, also has state laws that require the reduction of methane. You know, the ponds that they use for manure and for the runoff, for example, have to be monitored and covered. They have an ambient standard statewide and several other states for hydrogen sulfide, too. Oregon does not have a statewide ambient standard for hydrogen sulfide. Okay.
Great.
And then on the behalf of the Yakima Indian Nation, Dr. Dan Jaffe performed another study, too, that took a look at when the Boardman power plant was offline, what did we see in the gorge as far as air pollution, and he determined through this study that Boardman has a significant influence on air quality and haze in the gorge. The worst air quality days are in the fall and getting into the winter, associated with this sort of stagnation effect in the East Gorge and the Columbia Basin and a down gorge wind. For those days, PG Boardman had a contribution of 7.4 micrograms per cubic meter of PM2.5 particles going into the gorge. That is very high. That's an incredibly high number. And what really crystallized here is that if you want to improve air quality in the gorge on the worst days, take a look at these big sources. PG Boardman is one of the big, if not the biggest source. And Dr. Jaffe determined that even a 50% reduction in all emissions from the plant would still just bring the haze level down, its contribution to haze in the gorge, down to 3.7 micrograms, which is still a very high level and causes visibility impairment. PG Boardman is our only coal-fired power plant in the state. It's uncontrolled for sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides. Of course, it's uncontrolled for CO2 because there's no federal requirement yet to control CO2. It's the largest source in the state of all three of those pollutants by far. With CO2 emissions, global warming gas, 5 million tons per year of CO2. It's the second largest source of mercury, a potent neurotoxin in Oregon. It's eclipsed only by the cement kiln operation in eastern Oregon, Ash Grove. It pollutes 11 Class 1 airsheds. Those are wilderness areas and national parks and the Columbia River Gorge. It's operating in violation of the Clean Air Act. And there is pending litigation seeking to compel compliance with the Clean Air Act. Continuing on that, the regional haze rule requires, it's part of federal law, Clean Air Act, requires natural levels of visibility in Class 1 airsheds like Mount Hood Wilderness Area would be an example. It's a somewhat long-term goal of 2064, but there are benchmarks where, like 2018, where you have to show reasonable progress towards attaining that goal. The DEQ and PG did work together, of course, with public input to adopt a regional haze rule that applied specifically to the Boardman plant. And that regional haze rule, while it will reduce pollution levels at the Boardman plant, our concern in a consortium of environmental groups is it still doesn't comply with federal law, and it'll still be the largest source, I believe, of sulfur in the states, second largest of NOx, nitrogen oxides, and it won't address the carbon issue at all. So we'll still have this source of 5 million tons of carbon uncontrolled in the state of Oregon. So I'd just like to wrap it up here, if I may. It's air quality is significantly degraded in the gorge. Sources on the west and east of the gorge are to blame. Transportation sources within the gorge also contribute. There are highways, trucks, and then, of course, the barges and the diesel fuel that they burn also contribute to air quality impacts. Coal plants and a large CAFO are the primary sources east of the gorge. Stationary sources, now including another power plant in Washington State, the Centralia TransAlta plant, and paper mills and other industrial sources in the west of the gorge contribute to air pollution. The DEQ and its companion agencies are required by law to adopt a comprehensive air quality strategy for the gorge, and we continue to support them doing that. And that concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have, now, or defer to experts that know a lot more than I do about this.
What were you saying about the gorge when we started this thing?
It's one of the most beautiful scenic areas in the state of Oregon.
Right. Could I ask this one? Well, could you give me the figures of the number of dairy cows and cattle in 9,900? How many?
Yeah, at Three Mile Canyon Farms?
Yeah.
The permit for dairy cattle, and now this is four-year-old information, was 93,000 dairy cattle. My understanding is that there are approximately 56 or 57,000 dairy cattle there currently. In addition, there are feedlots where they finish beef before going to market, and that would be 25 to 28,000 cattle, you know, that are finished there for a period of, I believe, 6 weeks at a time. So the combined total is, 95,000, I believe?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, 86,000. But I'm sure representatives of Three Mile Canyon Farms could give you more up-to-date accurate numbers on that.
Okay.
So it's a lot.
Well, thank you very much.
You're
welcome. We don't have time to discuss this in depth, but I certainly wanted to have you come and give your perspective on this.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we'll close the informational hearing on environmental health in the Columbia Gorge, and we'll now call Randy Ray and Teresa Miller up, because this is going to deal with combining health benefit contributions from multiple employers, and it is a bill that we are going to fix, I think. No, this isn't it.
Teresa Miller's going to fix this bill.
Okay. Teresa's
going to fix which bill?
No, we're talking about something else. I thought we were going to talk about the 2116 fix, but this is something different. Yes, okay. And committee, I had Life Bank come talk to me in my office, and I told them that they that I would like to have them propose give us a presentation on their products, so to speak.
Thank you, Senator Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Randy Ray. I'm from Washington State, but my family originally came to Oregon in 1850. We got flooded out and moved to the Washington Territories in 1852. I did graduate from Oregon Episcopal Schools, and when I was on the student council, I was on the student council with Betsy Johnson and Ben Westland. So, know a little bit about Oregon. I I actually started my career as a lobbyist in Washington State, representing the wheat growers, the apple growers, so an ag industry, the fish industry, and the temp industry. And we could never get health care to those folks because they had temporary part-time and seasonal jobs. So for years we said there's got to be a solution for that. And what we've done is come up with a solution. We're operating in multiple states. We just got approved in Ohio by the insurance commissioner back there working with the state. And we're here. We don't need legislation, we believe, but we're here to offer more money to go into health care in the state. And in our market that we're selling to is the uninsured. You have 600,000 people who are uninsured in Oregon, and those are the folks, and most of them work, and that is our market, and we believe we can now get them health care. Most of them only earn between $8 and $12. 40% of them are between the ages of 18 to 35 years old, and those people are often working. Ethnic groups make up about 40% of that. And as you know, those are likely to receive health care in hospitals and emergency room, which drives uncompensated care costs. Said 58.7% on a national basis either work full or part-time, and many are in small business or in agriculture. So the problem is they're part-time, seasonal, and serial. They don't fit in a group market. You have to have a full-time job year-round to fit in a group market. So it doesn't work. Small group market doesn't work for most of these people, nor does a large group market. Or they have multiple employers. They move from job to job to job throughout the year. A farm worker, somebody in the forest industry, a nursery, they move around. Or you have a family that's got five people working in it, but only one employer under the old condition of ERISA could pay for health care. The other four employers could not put in money but by pre-tax. And the other problem we're having more and more is you have full-time people who have a job, but the employer is requiring them to pay 25, 30, 40, 50% of that premium, and they simply can't afford it. And as you all know, that is causing big stress. In fact, the paper this morning is talking about the cost of health care in the Oregonian this morning. Health care costs are going up. Families need more money to go do it. So, you know, one of the problems is we've been talking to pharmacy associations across the nation. You know, pharmacy provides a group plan. You guys with SCHIP maybe pick up Joey, but Jane, they can't afford to get on the plan. Or Steve's company used to pay for everybody. Now they pay for him, and they can't afford to put Alice and David on with the co-premium. Or a big problem which we have in Oregon, which is in rural families. I grew up in Eastern Washington, worked in the potato processing plants. I worked at a plant. You'd work there 80 hours a week. And because these people have multiple jobs and move around, they don't get health care. They do not fit in a group market plan. So I asked a question. We went back 4 years ago to D.C. and said, we hired the top ERISA law firm in the nation. I said, can more than two employers pay into a person's health care accounts? And the attorney said, I'll call you back. Called me back a week later, said, I've been an ERISA attorney for 25 years, firm's been here for 50 years, and nobody's ever asked us that question before. And the answer is the law changed. And the answer is yes, you can do that. And this is what we do. This has never been done before in the history of this country. And we work with the Groom Law Group, and you can now get health care for all these folks. And we also believe we can take Joey off of SCHIP. We can take him off of potentially Medicaid that he's on, because we're now bringing in money for everybody. We're launching our LifeVault Visa debit card that allows all these employers to put pre-tax money into a person's account. The person owns the account, not the employer. If you leave that employer, you take your money that you earn for health care with you. And so you can have all these different jobs, and the money you have on that card can be used to buy a premium, can use to be paid deductible, copay, prescription, vision, or dental, long-term care. You can even walk into Fred Meyer, get a toaster, a magazine, a prescription, cough syrup, and aspirin, swipe this card, it will pay for the prescription, the cough syrup, and aspirin. It will not pay for the toaster, and it will not pay for the magazine. It's 213D automatic adjudicated expenses at point of purchase. It's a deal we worked out nationally with Visa. The other thing we can do is many people, as I said, have a group plan. They can't afford to go on the co-premium on the group plan with their post-tax money. We can now bring in those other employers' money to help pay that co-premium to keep that family on that group plan, which is simply was not affordable before. And on the rural family, that's what we can do. All of a sudden, we're currently working with migrant workers. We think the Hispanic market's a big market for us. The ag market's a big market for us. Nurseries, agriculture. We're working with seafood industry. Those people move from boat to boat to boat, from the crab industry to the salmon industry to the halibut industry. Because they're working for different employers, they couldn't get health care before. We can now let them pool the money together from all their employers. Employers like this. What many people don't realize is there's a pent-up demand of health care out there. And here's an example. Fred's employer, small employer, couldn't afford the $5 an hour to provide health care for Susan and the kids. Susan's employer couldn't pay it either. That's the problem we have in health care. You pay $5 or you pay zero for the employer. We come in with a different choice. We say, can you pay $3? Two, one. Employers go, well, I can pay $3. I can do that. All of a sudden, Fred and Susan have got $6 an hour, enough to buy the health care, cover all of them, and they have some money left over. It's a new way to go do health care. We call it a 21st century finance solution. It's kind of, these are the new employees. Employees get individually controlled, fully funded health care accounts. Every pay period, for the money they earn, we move it out of the employer's account into the employee's account. They have total control over it. The money's held in trust at a federally chartered bank, and then we put it on the Visa network. We spend all the money. If they have a policy, the money is sent to the carrier electronically, so the person doesn't even have to worry about writing a check for it. It's all done electronically. The account and the individual or family policy are portable. They're owned and chosen by the people, the family, the person, and it's portable job to job. These are defined contributions from an employer. It's all pre-tax money. Can only be used for health care. You can quit your job, take your money with you, but the money can still only be used for health care. If you have money left in your account and you pass, you can give it to your heirs, but they can still only use it for health care. This is not an HSA. HSAs, you can take the money out and buy a big screen TV. There is no way to use this money except for health care. And as I said, we can combine. You got a husband or wife right now that both work for a company, both are eligible for health care, but you're on one policy or you're on the other policy. We can now combine the money or take the money from both employers and let them have double. We have couples now that have two different employers where one employer was paying $500, the other employer was zero. Now both employers pay $500 and they have $1,000 a month to go out and buy health care. For the employer, it's easy. They just pick the amount of money that they are going to pay. They can reimburse different for management, salary, and hourly folks. It works great for part-time. We have national retailers that are working with us because they can't get health care for their part-times. They want to get them to sign up, but they won't sign up, so they've contracted with us to go out and reach across the nation. We have a pilot project we're starting in Massachusetts and San Francisco and Alaska for this national retailer because they want their people covered, but their system doesn't work, their group policy doesn't work for their part-timers, and they're asking us to go in and finally get it for those people for the first time. And so it's easy to go do it. The other thing is it's a flexible system. If you want to leave those full-time folks on a group policy and put the part-time and seasonal folks on our system, that works fine too. We actually have had some companies where the executives have gone on our system and they've left the other people on a group policy. And there's an ERISA tripwire that happens with, and I've got friends who work for county government. They work 31 hours a week, week after week, 3 years in a row, and they're classified as part-time and don't get any health care benefits. We can now solve that where the county just pays them like $2 an hour, goes in their account, and they can go out and buy the health care benefits they need for themselves and their family. I said all employee classes can be covered seamlessly, no management hassles for employers. Now I'm going to go on to a different thing. We are currently working with a number of states on trying to address the problems the state have for paying for their own health care programs. This is in Washington State, the Basic Health Plan. I think you have what's called the Oregon Health Plan. I believe they're very similar. We're in negotiations right now with the state. Right now, we started with 100,000 people on it. That has now dropped because of budget cuts. 43% budget cut last session of the Basic Health Plan. They are shedding people off of it. Right now, there's more people on the waiting list to go on the Basic Health Plan because of the economy. And most of these people all work, but they don't fit on a group plan with their employer. They're with a small employer. They're with agriculture. They can't fit on there. So We have a new proposition for you. Say, for example, right now, John and Jane are on the basic health plan in Washington. They can't, right now the state's paying for 100% of that. They pay a little bit, the state pays 90% of the rest or so. And the question is, what if you're able to bring in that employer's money to go with, to bring down the contribution for the state? What if you were to take that $480 between those four employees, they need $625, the state was paying for 80% of that, and all of a sudden say, I can now bring in employer money, pre-tax employer money from those employers on a voluntary basis, and you would be surprised at the number of employers who want to pay. We walk into employers all the time, half the people we've signed up never provided health care before. The other half we've signed up are businesses who are about ready to drop their healthcare, group health care plan because they just got the last increase of 30-40% and said, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. This is out of my ballpark. And they find us as the safety net. We're not out to go take the group market. In fact, we don't know of any group that we've, a group that we've had that wasn't ready to drop their plan. We're the safety net. We're the bottom of the market. I'm not interested in anybody in an office building in downtown Portland. I'm interested in that janitor who doesn't have health care. We're signing up part-time daycare workers and getting them health care for the very first time because the employer can actually pay something. We got a daycare worker signed up. A daycare is paying $200 a month for their part-timers. They've always wanted to do health care, couldn't afford it, found us. We've got the person a primary care medical home for $60 a month and a policy for $100 a month, and they bank $40 a month on their card to go to the drugstore to help pay their drug bills. It takes not that much money, and when you offer that to employers, employers go, I'll do it. When you offer that, we're signing up in Washington State wineries, not just for their management, but for the people who work in the retail shop and the people who work in the fields. We're getting farm workers for the first time. But we're working right now with the Washington State Legislature, and we're talking to other states. We're talking to Tennessee, and we're talking to Florida. If you have somebody on a subsidized health plan, and they have a job, can you bring in that employer money? So instead of the state paying a set group fee, you just pay the delta of what the employers can't pay. And so instead of our state, for example, right now our state pays... The employee contribution, the monthly state cost on the basic health plan is $290. Average employee right now is paying $55, and the state is paying $235. I think I was talking to a legislator the other day. The whole idea of the Oregon health plan was to be a three-legged stool. The person pays something, the state pays something, the employer pays something. The issue was ERISA, you could never figure out how to get that employer to pay something. We believe we have solved that problem. And so we approached the Washington State Legislature as well as Tennessee, and if you just got, let's say the person works full-time, and you get to that employer and you get $1 an hour for that person working, so $160 is all, what does it do to that $23 million a month that the state's paying for the VHP? That's what it does. It drops their cost down to $7.5 million from $23 million for only $1 an hour that employer pays for health care on a voluntary basis. Employers want to do the right thing. We are reaching across the country. They want to pay. They just can't pay that $5. But when you give an alternative, they go, I can pay something. And they are into paying something. In fact, Washington legislature is looking at this, said if you look down to the next line, $150,000, there we're paying $23 million, we could increase the rolls by 50%, and they'd still only be paying $11 million. It's a real opportunity. Here's another one. 2 months ago, David Wilhelm, who was Bill Clinton's campaign manager, was a good supporter of ours, took me to see Barry Merrim. Barry Merrim runs the Medicaid division for the state of Illinois. And I said, Barry, what if there's a bunch of people who work on Medicaid, who are on Medicaid, and some of them are eligible for health care? That employer can give them money, but they can't get onto their plan because it's probably the co-premium they can't get on. What if you were just to get some money out of that employer and give it to the state? Pick a dollar an hour again. And the employer contribution for the employee is moved to us, and we pay it, and it's used to pay the state portion of the 50-50 state-federal match. Can one do that? We have several states who are working with their attorneys trying to see if we can go do that. That might take a piece of legislation, and probably the Oregon Health Plan would take a piece of legislation. Everything else, we believe we're currently legal. We have to certainly work with Ms. Miller. She is our commissioner, and we came down 2 years ago to meet with Scott Kraling. I pronounced it right.
I think you met with Joel Ario and then with Scott Kipper.
And so we want to stay inside the box. We ask permission, not forgiveness, from insurance commissioners. So we can do new things. The issue for workers, employers, and governments is this little thing called ERISA. And that's a big box one has to stay inside of. And our law firm has worked. We have been across the country. We have been approved by insurance commissioners. Ms. Miller, we met with her yesterday. She had some technical concerns of what we were doing. We think some of her concerns are unfounded because they had us in the wrong box. And we look forward to continuing those discussions with her to show that we continue to meet federal law. We are, one of the things that always somebody's going to ask if you're talking about health care, how are we going to do on federal health care reform? We are currently been working with the U.S. Senate. I actually have five lobbying firms in D.C. We've met with the Health Committee. We've met with the Finance Committee. We've met in the House. One of the things about the federal legislation is it applies to full-time employees. Your part-time, seasonal, and serial employees still are not covered. Many of them may still have been up in exchange, where they're going to have a full or a partial subsidy. If they don't have a full subsidy, they're going to need money from the employers. And so we are still very much, even with federal health care reform, still in the game. The issue is, though, that there's millions of hours worked. Families want health care. Employers want to pay. But employers cannot contribute dollars for coverage nor share cost. Billions of voluntary dollars across this country are being prevented from being spent on health care for workers. The old economy model, which is the group plan, works for lots of people. Lots of them. Not my market. But our market is those part-time, those serials, those seasonals, those small businesses that can't afford that $5. That is our market, the people who can't get health care, the 600,000 people who are uninsured, the people on the Oregon Health Plan, that is our market. We're at the bottom. And we believe those people have employers who will pay money. That's all.
Okay. The reason I find this an interesting concept, because I think the goal in Oregon is to help small businesses who are dropping their insurance and getting them on board. And you know, we passed some major legislation, so we are in the process of coming up with some new models so that we can get most of our uninsured covered. And so that's why I wanted you to come present, because this is a concept, and I think that it needs to be shared with the health authority that is newly formed and be working on that, so that concepts like these can be discussed, because the idea is to keep our businesses providing health insurance, and if somehow we can have the state and the employer as well as the individual contribute, so be it. So, Teresa, I asked you here because I know you had talked about them before. Do you have a few comments that you'd like to share?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I have provided written testimony that outlines some of the concerns just in terms of existing law and the ability to implement some of what Mr. Ray talked about today with existing law. But I think, Madam Chair, your comments are very appropriate in that I think we're on the verge of a new market, whether that comes in terms of federal reforms or whether it comes in terms of the work that the Oregon Health Authority and we will be doing with them. I think we're going to see different markets in these two areas, in the individual and small group market. And I think this is a really interesting model to think about as we look forward to changes in our market. So with that, I don't want to take any more of the committee's time. I've provided written testimony. Happy to answer any questions. And we will continue to work with Mr. Ray and look at any other models he wants us to look at. And again, I do think as the Oregon Health Authority and all of us move forward, these will be interesting models to look at.
Yeah. Questions? Thank you. I really appreciate your presentation, Mr. Ray, and thank you, Ms. Miller, for being here. I'm excited about health reform here in the state of Oregon, and we want to make sure that we have all of the models in front of us that we can choose from.
We hope we can help out. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. With that, I'd like to close the informational hearing on Life Bank, and let's open an informational hearing on dental practice ownership. And this is, so I'd like to call Steve Petrozelli and representatives of the Oregon Dental Association. I think, is it Patrick? Is he here? Yeah. Brotz. Colleagues, this has been an issue that we have dealt with, you have dealt with, Senator Cruz has dealt with for many, many years, and I would like us to get a better handle on this and see if there are some changes that we can do, because I do personally feel that it is an archaic system in the state of Oregon compared with other states, but I want to make sure that we're doing things in the best interest of the dentists of Oregon, but also for consumers in Oregon. So who would like to go first? Okay. Mr. Petrozelli.
First, thank you, Madam Chair, and other board members for having us and taking the time. I'm Steve Petrozelli with Willamette Dental Group. I've been with the organization, I hate to admit it, but it's almost 31 years now. So, a brief history. This issue first came up almost 8 years ago, I believe now, when the Dental Practice Act was modified and some changes, and most of the stakeholders got together at that time and really agreed on, I believe it was on 7 or 8 points that we were basically able to come back to the legislatures to make changes. The 8th point was on minority ownership. At that time, and as it still exists today, you have to have 100%. A dentist has to own 100% of the dental practice in order to practice in the state of Oregon. That's not to say that management services can't be contracted for, and even our organization has operated under that model simply because we have a dentist as our owner of not only the dental practice, but our other entities also as 100% stockholder. But this issue was... let sleeping dogs lay for a number of years until legislative session of 2009 when SB 117 came up, which was to grant the Institution of Higher Education also the ability to practice dentistry without a dentist owning the practice to accommodate ongoing operations at Portland State University and U of O. Meaning Willamette Dental Group, is one of those kind of raised our hands about that, because every time you make another exception, it weakens the existing proposition that only dentists can own a dental practice. As an example, right now, the exceptions are labor unions, surviving spouse of a dead dentist for a period of time, local governments, nonprofit corporations in rural areas serving migrant, rural, or homeless populations, educational or training programs, nonprofit charitable organizations, staffed by volunteers, and now the previously mentioned higher education facilities that have those. And I think in the future you're going to, some people are going to be asking for another exception, probably for some of the school-based healthcare clinics that are being set up around the state. And a side comment, I think that's appropriate probably in the future, because I do think a lot of services can be done with our children much more economically if we can take the dentistry to where these people are, either in the schools or the early Head Start programs. That's a side issue. But it begs the issue now as, you know, what does this really mean? I will say that dentistry is probably together on one issue. I don't think anybody, including our own organization, wants to see dental office ownership, in, at least in the private environment, move to a situation where it can be owned, majority ownership by a non-dentist. I think where the controversy lies, and the stakeholders in dentistry have been meeting with no resolution yet, as to whether we should stay with 100%, as some would view, even though a larger percentage of our population is, quite frankly, being seen by in dental practices that aren't owned by dentists. And those of us who might say, you know, maybe let's take a look at the physician model that's been operating for a number of years successfully. It still retains control to the physicians, but you can have a 49% minority ownership that's non-physician. They've operated under that for a number of years now.
What is the...
49%, up to 49%.
Needs to be owned by physicians?
No. The physician would own
51%.
Up to 49%
yeah.
Could be non-physician ownership. And they've not only operated under that a number of years, but under that system, they've expanded to bring in the nurse practitioner and physician assistant concept that has worked very well. And it's something I think that dentistry is beginning to move forward with LAP hygienists and this idea of a mid-level provider, which I think will bring other ownership issues up and control issues in the future. So the question really begs, as we're going along, as to when we talk about only a dentist can own a dental practice, who are we really going to be talking about in the future? There's been rapid expansion of the federal qualified health care clinics in the state. That will continue to expand. Their charter calls for them to be able to provide dentistry either directly or through subcontract. And here again, they're not dental-owned dental practices. So I think increasingly larger and larger segments of our Oregon State population are going to be treated in by dentists in facilities that aren't owned by those dentists. Part of that, I think, is just what is happening in healthcare in general. We see it at the federal and the state level. As we move more and more, I guess, towards universal coverage, and the Children's Healthy Children's Program here in the state, there's going to be more than enough work for all of us to do. I'm not so sure all of it is going to be done in what has been a traditional dental environment, at least as it relates to dentistry now. The other issue is we talk a lot about transparency and the need for the various medical disciplines, and I'm including dentistry as primary care in that, to better cooperate and communicate back and forth. This means e-charting, being able to communicate electronically, but also verbal and written communication. And I have to believe you see some of the directions where dentistry and oral health has an important impact on some of the systemic diseases that we see developing, some of the scientific evidence, that down the road, maybe dentistry will actually become more and more integrated with healthcare. And I think that if we have a law that's very similar, allowing 45% minority ownership, very similar to what the physician has, which doesn't detract from some of the board's issues that we'll get to in a minute, it can help accommodate that integration in the future as it moves along. I think that perhaps, you know, 5-10 years from now, you may start to see dental practices integrated in with medical practice for a lot of useful reasons. And I don't think we should, in the future, allow this type of development to be maybe retarded because we have all these different disciplines having a different set of criteria as to ownership and what can be done at management company levels and things.
Yeah, Madam Chair,
yes.
Steve.
Yes.
Yeah. But that does bring up an interesting conundrum.
Uh-huh.
If you go to the medical model of 49% and then you're co-locating with with a physician and you both have the 49%.
Uh-huh.
How do you get there?
Well, no, what I was getting at more is that it may be that some medical groups might have a 49% interest in the in a dental practice, but the dentist still has the 51% of that practice.
So you can be...
Still controls the charts, the patients, and what goes on in the operatory.
Which I have no problem
yeah.
with, but the facility itself is
right.
what we're talking about. And,
right.
And so a dentist is co-locating with a physician.
Mm-hmm.
and this is the facility.
Right.
And but if you each have, if both the physician and the dentist have a law that says they can only have 49% minority ownership, which means they both have to have 51%, how do you resolve that?
Well, I was thinking more that it would be their management company, as with the physicians that maybe owns 49% of the practice that the physician owns. 51%, that same management company may own 49% of the dental practice, but the dentist owns 51%. So it's not the physician and the dentist owning, splitting up the remaining 51%. It's still the same management.
Yeah, Madam Chair, my issue is, you know, a dentist should have control of his practice.
Absolutely.
A doctor should have control of his practice, where they're located.
Right.
I mean, we kind of get...
No. And all I was attempting to make the point is that there is rapid evolution going on in healthcare in this country, finally. And I think that how we look at models, and there probably are going to be models out there in the future that we're not even thinking about today, as the evolution occurs, I am just looking for opportunities to have different models grow based on the market system that of, you know, those that the public accepts and those that don't. And it seems to me that having systems that are very similar within the disciplines within healthcare, as far as ownership and some of the other rules and regulations, is a step in the right direction, so that when we sit down and discuss possibilities, we know across the disciplines that it'll be the same for everybody as we move into these different potential models and everything. I know that the board has some concerns, and they've been very good in working with these in practices or in situations where dentists do not own the practice. They've set up a system where the dental director, they insist on a dental director be in that facility and be accountable for the quality of the dentistry and what goes on in that dental practice, so that they have accountability within the system. And the last point, and I don't want to put words in Patrick's mouth, but in discussions that we have had in the past, we've talked about, is there any discernible difference in the amount of complaints and the quality of the dentistry that you see coming in from dentist-owned practices and those practices in which dentists are actually seeing patients in facilities that aren't owned by the dentist? And I believe his statement was no discernible difference. I hope you're not going to jump up and say you lie.
No.
Okay. Okay.
But
with that, I could go on and on, but I will stop my remarks at this point to give my two colleagues here an opportunity to...
Before you go on, you know we're in major health care reform in this state, as far as I'm concerned, and with the health authority. And I feel that dental care amongst our children has been neglected grossly. So many of our children do not have access to proper dental care. So whatever changes, my goal is so that we can have access for our kids, because they all don't go to a private dentist. They just don't. I think that we have opened up the doors by being able to allow dental hygienists to do screenings, et cetera, but they still need to then be referred to a clinic or a dentist that will take them. So with that caveat, I'd love to have the Dental Association give us their views.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, the committee. For the record, my name is Nikki Terzieff, and I am your representative of the Oregon Dental Association, as listed on the agenda. I think Mr. Petrozelli gave a good kind of background or in history of some of this. Perhaps the exemption to allow surviving spouses and children was kind of some of the open door which led down this path for some of the other exemptions, which I understand is a concern. So having that exemption, I just want to say, for our professionals was a really important step. It's for them, for their families, and it's one that we can kind of all agree on, I think. It makes sense business-wise. So we look at this ownership issue in several aspects, and the most important one, I think, is the safety for the patient, the comfort and of the public, the well-being of the public. And I don't think that it's a large stretch of the imagination to assume that a business owner in a clinic, dental, medical, whatever it is, may have a different or may have additional points of view and additional viewpoints than the actual practitioner. So our main concern is that a dental director, for instance, or a dentist that is going to be solely responsible and carry the liability is going to have to be put in a position of having undue burden, undue pressure from the business side of things. And we don't want to see patients over-served, underserved. They deserve the right service from us. So we're looking at bolstering with the board's opinion, or again, we won't put words in Patrick's mouth, but standing along with the board and ensuring that they have the ability to investigate, that they have the authority to have the files. So where the business can own the bricks and the mortars and the chairs and the spittoons, the files and the practice, and Senator Cruz, you nodded to this, thank you, do belong with the dentist and with the professional. I would say, just in response to the access piece and to the concern for children receiving health care, that this is a huge priority for dentists. And dentists and our professional association have taken steps. We've got the tooth taxi that travels around the state and has been in districts, and that is based on needs and based on districts with needs. So we share this concern for access with you, Chair. I guess I'm concerned that changing an ownership policy will not directly reflect a change in access. I'm concerned that a change in ownership policy will maybe benefit the owners of the business and the clinic itself, but not necessarily translate into greater services for their patients. And to speak, I guess, to the home health, health home aspect of things, having uniform statute in that sense, or having dental statute that may match more closely with medical statute, will require a greater overhaul, which I suppose we are in the middle of, but then definitely a longer conversation than what we may have time for today. And billing systems, for example, are different when you look at a dental office as compared to a medical office. We'll do bundled fees versus itemized fees. That's just an example. I think something that we could all agree on is a nonprofit idea of a nonprofit exemption, something that allows nonprofits, such as these school-based health centers, to operate and provide services, open up the door for access, and still kind of employ and protect our professionals.
Is there how does accountability work with the billing process when you bundle? I mean, is there a transparency and an audit system that is built into this?
Well, certainly, and I would say in a practice owned by a dentist, when a dentist is doing their own billing and taking care of those things, a patient receives the bill, they receive the invoice and can look at it and can discuss it. And individual practices have a greater ability to negotiate and make arrangements for billing services, billing cycles, payments, arrangements, and adjustments, things like that, which that may be lost in a clinic situation where a non-dentist owner owns the dental clinic itself and is in charge of the billing processes, or those services are contracted out. Am I answering the question?
Well, yeah, I don't know enough about the billing and the accountability and the transparency, which we as a legislature want to see, and we are demanding in health care reform, because that's a part of the problem. We feel that we want to make sure that they're efficient, they're accountable, they're transparent, and that's just a question that I propose on the billing processes from a dental perspective.
And if I may, I would say that regardless of the ownership statute, that would be a good
mm-hmm.
question
Absolutely.
To ask.
Absolutely.
Thank
Chair Morris Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patrick Bratz. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Dentistry. What I handed out for you today, and I apologize, I found there's a couple typos in it. I took the enroll bill of Senate Bill 117, which made the changes in the law so we could talk about the law today and how this affects. And if you just give me a couple minutes to go through it, I can walk you through the process. Basically, in Oregon, there are three entities that can own a dental practice. And there's a definition of what is a dental practice, and I'll get into that as well. One of the entities, obviously, is a dentist. The other entity is, as has been stated, if a dentist dies, their family, a receivership, could also own a dental practice. And then there's these various exemptions, a labor organization, the School of Dentistry, the institutions of higher education, which is a new exemption that got added, local governments, institutions or programs accredited by COTA, and then the two various not-for-profits. Those institutions or those groups that have an exemption can own a dental practice, but then they have to name a dental director. They have to have someone that is in charge and someone that is responsible for what goes on. From the board standpoint, this law works relatively well at this point, because what you have to understand is a dental practice is not the building. It's not the equipment. It's not the accounts receivable. It's not the people that work in the office that aren't the licensed dentist. The dental practice is the relationship that the dentist has with his or her patient and the records that support that practice. And those are the issues that are key to the Board of Dentistry. As it works right now, no one can get in between the Board of Dentistry and a dentist in those patient records. We can't have someone say, well, I own this company and you're not going to have the records. We have to have the ability to have those records, and the way we have that ability is we hold the dentist's license. If he or she refuses to give up those records, we'll take action against that particular license. Second to this is the fact that it is the board's belief that no one should direct dental care except someone that is a dentist. Now, I can tell you right now that we have three complaints that we're investigating, and I have to be careful how I phrase this because complaints under investigation are not public. But we have three cases right now we're looking at where there are instances, and they're not Steve, so I can tell you that right off the bat, where they are entities that have gotten in between the direction of dental care, where they have made decisions not just on a monetary issue, but that there are options available to a dentist, and those options are not being allowed to be given to the patient. And so we are very seriously investigating those cases. And so obviously any change to this law we would want to look at. I want to take a moment to answer Chair Anderson, Morris Anderson, your question on access. I'm not an Oregonian. I came here 7 years ago to accept this position. And during this time, I have seen both the Dental Association, the Dental Hygiene Association, and a variety of groups come to the board and come to the legislature for an expansion to the dental practice as to who can actually practice different parts of dentistry. I've seen changes made into who we can license and who we can't license. And I have to tell you that it doesn't matter how many more people we bring in the state to license. It doesn't matter how many more people we allow to take little bits of dentistry and allow them to do it. If we don't have the ability for those people to get to those services and pay for those services, you are never going to solve the access problem. And I tell you this as a consumer, not as a dentist, because I am not a dentist, but I could put a dentist on every street corner in Portland, along with a hygienist and an assistant. If people couldn't get to them and they can't pay for their services, there is not going to be a change in access. And that's, I know that we're in a financial crisis in this state, in this country, but that is the issue. That is the bottom line issue for access. We're looking even now, we've got another committee looking at mid-level practitioners. You know, that may be a great concept, but again, even if you get to that person, if you can't pay for your services, it's not going to matter what we have. So from our standpoint, you know, we don't have a dog in the fight, in the sense, as long as we have the ability to do our job as a Board of Dentistry, which is to handle the complaints, no one can get in the way of those records, and no one should be directing dental care except someone that has the dental license or the dental education. That's the board standpoint.
And I don't have an issue with that, but I do have an issue with the fact that, and I'm hoping that the health authority can come up with a basic benefit package, because when we, in my eyes, especially with children, and now that health care coverage for children is, we're getting there with the legislation that we passed in 2009. If they don't have good oral hygiene and oral care, they're not going to be learning. They are not
right.
going to become productive citizens, and that is a huge, huge issue. Whatever changes that we make, I want to make sure that we keep that at the forefront. But I guess my question is, I think we're the only state, or is there one other state that has complete dental ownership?
Madam Chair, there's a couple of other states. I think Maryland is one, and I'm not sure who the other state is specifically.
And it seems like it would be nice to, when we pursue this, to look at other models. And I would love to have the Oregon Dental Association come forward with other models in other states that are appealing, so that we can not be quite as archaic. I feel it's archaic, but still meet the needs of the dentists in the state of Oregon, because I think we are unique. But the fact that most other states don't have this means that it is working in other states, and I would just, when we pursue this, and I do plan to pursue it after one of our sessions, after the February, in starting to look at other models in other states, and if you could help us with that, I would appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, this is the information that I needed. We sort of needed a broad base of where you're coming from. Are there... because I would like to move forward with making so that entities don't have to keep coming to the legislature, and we're spending thousands of dollars to make an exception for another entity like we did last session. So that's what I want to start avoiding. And if there is legislation that we can come forward so that everyone who has an exception keeps coming forward, I mean, school-based health centers is an obvious. We're now going to be having an integrated home. And how is this going to affect dental care? So I think we need to be working with the health authority also is part of this basic benefit package going to be a dental care also, which I feel is an absolute mess, but you know, that is not in our purview. So let's schedule for our next meeting after that we will be looking at other models, and then we may have to then establish a task force or something to come up with some consensus, because I don't want a warfare. I'd rather be doing a lot of work ahead of time. Okay? Any other comments?
I just want to make clear again, I think everybody at the table agrees. It's a matter of degree. Nobody wants to see dental ownership go below, owned by a dentist, 51%. Whether it's 100 or 49%, I guess, is the issue,
mm-hmm.
And everything, because we all want to see dentistry certainly operate effectively in the 21st century based on the realities of the population basis that are going to need to be served. At the same time, we want to see at the same time that it protects its identity as a discipline within overall healthcare also. I don't want to see it break down into a sub-discipline by going too far in the other direction.
All righty. Well, I don't have a huge staff, so we're going to need to get someone to pursue this to get information both from both of you on various models.
The ODA, along with other stakeholders within dentistry, is we've had meetings. We're not all in the same
board,
but we'll continue to have those meetings and come back with something.
Well, we
before
want
you.
At our next probably September. Is that after the February?
Haven't
been, but that will be the goal, to have some models be brought before us. Okay.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the time that you spent in preparing for this presentation. With that, I'd like to close the informational hearing on dental practice ownership, and I'd like to open an update on psychologist prescriptive authority work group. We've had a work group, and yes, Senator Morissette?
Oh, nothing.
Okay.
I said, oh, goody. Yeah,
okay.
Laurel Singer and Laura Smith and John McCulley. And I've attended one. They've had three meetings, and I'm excited that they're meeting and coming up with some, hopefully, collaborative legislation.
It doesn't have anything to do with what we just heard, because originally it was committed to
answer any questions.
Okay. All right. Who wants to go first?
I'm going to go first.
All right. Thanks.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide you with an update on the work of the House Bill 2702 work group on prescriptive authority for licensed psychologists. I'm Laurel Singer. I am a program manager with Oregon Consensus at Portland State University, and we've been sponsored by the Oregon Psychiatric Association, as represented by John McCulley, and by the Oregon Psychological Association, as represented by Laura Smith, to convene the work group. And what we've presented with you is an update, a report from the facilitator on the progress that's been made by that work group to date. So as you mentioned, the group has met three times. So I want to walk you through some of the key points in that report, which has been, by the way, reviewed and approved by the work group itself. They've seen it and support it.
And can you remind us again who's on that work group?
There are representatives of... Do you want to have a little bit? Number of representatives.
Well, actually, I've got them right here. I think it's on the last page, but for the record, could you please...
Senator Monis Anderson, I'm Laura Smith, representing the Oregon Psychological Association, and representing my association is Dr. Robin Henderson, Dr. Linnea Lindsay, and Dr. Morgan Sammons.
And they are all clinical psychologists?
Yes, they're all clinical psychologists. Dr. Henderson works in a hospital setting. Dr. Sammons is a Department of Defense trained psychologist, so he is a prescribing psychologist. And Dr. Lindsay has a master's in psychopharmacology and has done some of the training to become a prescribing psychologist if we get to that point.
And the reason I ask for the specifics, because I know on the back page we have a list of everyone, mm-hmm. but when I'm in caucus, they're saying who is on it. And I can quote the legislation, but I can't describe who these people are and where they're from. So if you could
Senator
get
Mark
that
Sanderson,
to us.
I'd be happy to provide you with bios of all of my folks. So.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, committee member, my name is John McCulley. I'm with the Oregon Psychiatric Association. The association doesn't have a representative per se on the task force, but the representatives were appointed by the Oregon Medical Board based on, I guess, recommendations, if you will, from our association. And I think they have been clear to state during the task force meetings that they do not represent anyone but themselves and OHSU, if that is who they're with. But primarily, they're representing themselves as psychiatrists. Mm-hmm. They are Dr. George Keepers, who is the head of the Department of Psychiatry at OHSU. Has an extensive background in rural practice as well as administrative practice working at OHSU. The other psychiatrist is Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson. He is the head of public psychiatry training at OHSU, assistant head of the Department of Psychiatry, and also with extensive background in working with in rural practice settings in various parts of the United States. Both of those positions were appointed by the Oregon Medical Board. The other appointment from the Oregon Medical Board is Dr. L.J. Fagnan, who is a family practice doc. And I'm trying to remember the title, the name of the organization that he also works with, Oregon Rural Family Practice. Help me out here,
sure,
something like that. But an excellent family physician and also excellent background to be a part of this work group. The pharmacist who was appointed by the Board of Pharmacy is Ann Hamer. She is, I think, faculty at Oregon State University School of Pharmacy and OHSU, is probably the leading authority on psychopharmacology medicines in Oregon, and maybe even broader than that, but really an expert and well trained in that area.
Thank you.
Okay.
So the work group has met three times since September, once a month, once in September, October, and then once this month, and we'll meet again later this month. In the course of those three meetings, they have really been trying to get grounded just in the task that's been laid out before them in House Bill 2702. And then they've really reviewed and considered the information that they feel they need in order to move forward in really developing good recommendations. And I am very pleased to report that they have made very good and thoughtful progress toward that end. To begin its work, the group developed and agreed on a set of operating principles that are also attached to the report. These principles were to clarify the purpose, membership, the scope of the effort, and establish guidelines for member participation in and out of the meetings. Specifically, the group agreed that the meetings would be closed work sessions and that any ideas and recommendations discussed in the meetings would remain a work in progress until the end of the process itself, when the recommendations would be fully presented to the legislature. The group reached consensus on these operating principles, which are all signed at the November meeting, and they're, as I said, attached for you to review. The group then has reviewed background substantive materials, and a list of the materials that they've been looking at are also in the report on the bottom of page 1 and at the top of page 2. So while a final decision of the group is not expected until their final meeting, which is scheduled for December 10th, the work group has addressed and reached an initial consensus on some recommendations regarding the training and educational program components that would be required if licensed psychologists were allowed to safely prescribe medications for the treatment of certain mental illnesses. So the current proposal that they're working on lays out the duration, topics, location, and supervision requirements of both the didactic and clinical training components. So the group has agreed that the specifics of these initial recommendations should be developed into draft language by the Legislative Council, and that's going to be reviewed by the work group as a whole on their next meeting, which is next week. The group has two more meetings scheduled to complete its work. The focus of those two meetings on November 24th and December 10th are going to be to really look at the potential costs to implement a training program, some of the recommendations for official oversight of prescribing psychologists, some of the statutory changes needed to accommodate the prescribing psychologists. These discussions, again, will stem from reviewing some of the information that is listed above, as well as language currently used in the Oregon laws that grant prescriptive authority for physician assistants, naturopaths, and optometrists. I think, again, the work group is making very steady progress toward accomplishing the task laid out in House Bill 2702, and it's really been a very thoughtful, respectful, and highly engaged group of experienced and respected members of various professions and perspectives. So we're pleased with the direction that it's going.
Excellent. Well, I attended one of the three, and I know that Representative Kennemer attended the first one. I think Representative Kotek attended the last one.
Right.
So you're having a presence of us because this is something very important, and we do want to be very thoughtful and make sure that it is a product that is sort of agreeable by both sides, so it looks like we're going in that direction.
Yes.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Well, then we may have, if there are conflicts, we may have in the January another update if there's conflicts. A committee bill has been submitted, and I know that as changes are being made, you're getting those changes to our administrator, Mr. Berkovian, and he's communicating with Legislative Council. All right.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You very Thank much. You. With that, no questions?
Okay.
Okay. Okay. If you want to wander down with Mr. Berkovian right now to Legislative Council, that would be fine. With that, I'll close the informational hearing on the
Psychologist Prescriptive Authority Work Group, and we'll open a informational hearing on having an update on impaired professional programs. Is Karen here? Oh, yes, Karen is here. Karen Wheeler from the Department of Human Services.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addiction Programs Administrator for the Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Authority. I'm here to provide you with a brief update on our progress toward implementing and designing a consolidated health professionals program. What we have done so far, and actually at the very beginning, once the bill passed, House Bill 2345 passed, we began stakeholder relationship building. And we have met monthly with the executive directors of the licensing boards who have existing programs currently in operation. And we will continue on meeting with them monthly as we design the program. We have developed a detailed timeline with a deliverables list with this group, with approval from this group. We've been researching other state programs. Some of the states have existing consolidated programs, and we've been looking at their programs and getting a lot of information from them, even some example requests for proposals and policies and procedures, forms and other documents from these other states. We have begun documenting elements of the existing programs that are in operation by the boards to look at the similarities and differences of these programs in terms of staffing patterns, the kind of philosophy that is behind the program, and other things. So that's going on right now, and we're documenting that. The governor's office has been very supportive and helpful to us as well through this process and attended our last meeting with the executive directors.
And the executive directors include?
Those directors are from the nursing board, Holly Mercer, the dentistry board, social work board, and pharmacist board. And then I always leave one
medical?
Out. The medical board,
mm-hmm.
Yes. We've also been reaching out to some staff who work with these various programs. For instance, the physicians have consultants who work with all of the physicians, and just last month I met with all of them. There's about 30 to 35 of those folks. We've made a decision with the boards to contract out the work of the monitoring program. So what we're doing right now is systematically going through the bill and all of the operational elements that need to be in place for the program and outlining those step by step with the boards and designing some questions and some key elements that need to be part of the new program. And these elements will be specified in the request for proposal that goes out for bid. We're also in
so
the
process. This will be an outside agency so that if there is an impaired nurse needs to go into a program or an impaired physician who needs to go on the program, it's this other, whoever you're going to have a contract with then? Is that where we're going?
Chair Mona Sanderson, correct. The monitoring program itself will likely be, it'll be a contracted program, and it'll be a nonprofit private organization okay. who does the monitoring. The treatment will be separate from that program. So people will go into their own, they'll pay for their own treatment programs separate from the monitoring.
Madam Chair, that's, I had issues with the bill when we did it because I thought the programs were working relatively well. The monitoring and oversight I didn't have a problem with. Is there going to be, The docs have their own protocols, the nurses have their own protocols. Is there, inside the discipline, is there going to be any autonomy there? I mean, for example, the docs do it this way and the nurses do it that way, are they still going to be able to do that, and then this outside agency is just going to kind of make sure that bad things aren't happening, or is everything changing?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, the way it's sort of shaping out, and all these questions really aren't answered yet. We're currently still in the process of designing what we want the program to look like, but a sense that I'm getting, and the staff who've been working with me so far, also I'd mention we're in the process of making an offer to hire a manager for the program at the department so that that person can really coordinate everything that's going to be part of this program, which it's quite detailed. There are some elements that I believe will need to be somewhat culturally unique based on the populations, the professional disciplines that will make up the participants in the program. All of the programs currently don't operate in the same exact way, mm-hmm. as you know, and there are some differences that I believe will need to transfer over to a new program, whatever that's going to look like. So I guess the answer is I do, at this point, believe that there will be a need to have some differences in the way the different populations are served.
Yeah, I guess, Madam Chair, it's just, you know, I know there were issues and specific cases that brought all this up, but to totally change something that, for the most part, has been pretty successful simply because there were individual bad results. I'm hoping we're not necessarily going to do that. So,
well, we don't really know, you know, from complaints that we have heard. I think Senator Morissette has gotten more than I certainly have, but that the worry is that the boards are protecting their own interests rather than the consumer, and so that's where we want to get at, and making sure that there's accountability.
Well, Madam Chair, on the monitoring oversight, I agree with that aspect of it. It's been a few years, but I've been to several of the OMA board meetings, and to say that they necessarily go out of their way to protect their own, I would say is not necessarily true. They tend to come down rather hard on their own. Now, they may protect them from scrutiny from the outside, but as far as what they do internally, they're pretty rigorous about it. And I guess that's the sort of thing I don't want to see us lose. Is, you know, one of my real fears in all of this is if this becomes too broad based, where is the certainty I have as a provider to make sure that if I'm seeking help, I'm going to get help and maintain my autonomy. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that just a general concern here. So,
Chairman Sanderson and Senator Cruz, one comment I would make about that concept or construct is that from the very beginning we've made it clear, and I think that's all of us, the department as well as the executive directors of the boards, that there's two key very important foundational elements of this program. Public safety is the first one, but recovery is another one.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure that people can approach the program, let's say they're not in trouble at work yet, they just need somewhere to go for some information and to get the right assessment or to get the right treatment, to make sure it doesn't become a problem at work, that this program is available and will be able to offer that help. So those two key foundational things are very important to us. If there aren't any other comments or questions in that regard, I would say that We've engaged the Department of Justice throughout this process to make sure that we have the legal advice that we need and that we have their perspective in terms of the legislative intent for this program as we design the new program. We're also right now working internally as well as with the boards to design some administrative rules, or at least get the concepts down, because they have administrative rules that they need to change. We don't have any yet, so we'll need to develop administrative rules. And once we get this manager on board, that work will really take off much at a faster pace. And we anticipate this person beginning December 1st.
And the funding is coming from the boards for this manager?
Chairman Sanderson, that is correct. Any of the costs that we incur right now, and then in the future when this new program is launched, July 1st of 2010, that will be an other fund transfer to the department to pay for this program.
Any other questions? Great. Thanks, Karen, so much for coming. And we will be having an update later on, maybe after the February session, or it depends. What we'll contact you to see what the progress is. Thank you.
Okay. That will close the informational hearing on the impaired professional program. That was House Bill 2345. And open an informational hearing on the Oregon State Hospital, an update on the new construction and treatment program. Mr. Orr and Linda Hammond, I see, are here, and there we go. Finding the cursor.
Make sure it's plugged to the USB port. The internet port is right next to it.
There we go.
Thank you.
You go down to the lower right hand corner. They have the old one.
That'd be great. Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Roy Orr. I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital, and I'm very pleased to have an opportunity to give you an update. I think the agenda refers to treatment programs. I may vary a little bit from that, but we are making significant progress in the area of formalizing our treatment programming and in a number of those areas, so I am pleased to have an opportunity to update you. The first slide, I would point out the progress on priorities is a little bit of a retrospective, if you will. A number of areas that were very high priorities about 21 months ago when I moved into this position and were significant priorities for the organization, such things as patient aggression, patient-on-patient aggression, patient-on-staff aggression. And while those will always be concerns and priorities for us, we'll talk a little bit as we go through this presentation about the advances that we've made. Unauthorized leaves, how we categorize any time one of our patients or residents leaves our custody or the confines of our facility. They're not necessarily escape. Sometimes it's a failure to return to the facility on time when they're on a pass with families. Talk a little bit about that and the reductions that we've made there. Staffing, which was a significant problem for the organization for many years. And the metabolic clinic. I'm sure committee members will recall that this was an item the U.S. Department of Justice pointed out as a serious deficit in our organization. But I'd also like to spend a lot of time, of the time that I have with you this morning, talking about our centralized treatment approach, which is arguably one of the most important changes that we are making, which will in fact allow us to achieve the kinds of goals for active treatment and hours of active treatment that the U.S. DOJ insists that we achieve in order to eventually get out from under their review. And within the centralized treatment concept, I'd like to also talk about this concept of active treatment, what we're doing in the area of treatment care planning and trauma-informed care, which is really caring for our own staff who have been either assaulted physically or have experienced some trauma through work. For too long, we've not extended the kinds of services to them that we would like to have, and we're doing that now, and I'm pleased to say that. And I'll also talk a little bit about H1N1. A conversation these days wouldn't be complete without a reference to H1N1. Before I start on this next slide, I might just mention, sort of parenthetically, since I mentioned the U.S. DOJ, I know committee members probably recall that ongoing investigation of the U.S. DOJ continued when they returned to our campus in late July this past summer. The U.S. DOJ returned with attorneys and experts in tow and spent 5 days on our campus, four in Salem and one in Portland. We had an exit conference where only the experts spoke to us. The attorneys made no comments whatsoever. I'm pleased to say that the experts recognized the accomplishments and the progress that we've made. They also pointed out we have a long way to go, and our mantra going into that return visit from the U.S. DOJ was progress, not perfection. And we were pleased to hear from the experts that we have, in fact, made progress. I might mention to the committee members, it's not at all clear to us, and there's certainly no obligation on the U.S. DOJ's part to issue another findings letter, such as Governor Kulongoski received in January of 08, I believe it was. They may not, in fact, issue another findings letter as a result of this investigation or this visit. We did not receive reports from the experts back in November of 06, and we were informed we will not receive reports from the experts again. So we took very careful notes at the exit conference from the experts, and we have incorporated some of those issues that came up in the exit conference in our continuous improvement plan. But I might just emphasize again, we don't have any certainty that we'll receive another findings letter as a result of their visit. So I'll move on with the slides and be happy to leave time to answer any questions you might have. As the slide clearly points out, our patient aggression incidents are well down. They were significantly down in 2008 throughout the year, and I'm pleased to say with the last quarter of data that we have clean data for the second quarter, we're down again in the number of incidents in the second quarter compared to the second quarter of 2008. Unauthorized leaves, far and away the majority of these ULs, as we call them, are in fact patients who are on a pass with family members. It's an extremely rare circumstance to have one of our patients escape from the secure perimeter, either in Portland or in Salem. And hats off to the Portland staff, where many of our unauthorized leaves did in fact occur with our civilly committed patients working toward the process of spending more and more time with families on passes and in the past too frequently running from family members when family members turned away for a moment. And the staff in Portland is doing a far better job of informing the family members of the importance of the time with the patient on a UL and preparing patients better for when they're on pass. I'm sorry, I said UL. And preparing the patients as well for their passes. In all cases of unauthorized leave, patients have been returned. Who were returning to campus were returned to campus quickly. So good news with regard to our unauthorized leaves. Staffing, as I mentioned, really plagued this organization for a great many years. I think it was something like six or seven years since the Oregon State Hospital had a full-time dedicated chief medical officer. There are a lot of people who serve very admirably in that role, part-time or interim, some of those kinds of designations. But the 1st of September, we brought Dr. Mark Diamond on board from Colorado. Mark has extensive experience in not only psychiatry, but institutional psychiatry and forensic psychiatry, and he's making a real impact already. That really rounds out our leadership team. Now we have our chief nursing officer on board. We have a superintendent on board. And the key leadership positions are filled for the first time in a very long time at the Oregon State Hospital.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Part of the problem before was that the chief medical officer was also the chief administrator.
It was a shared duty for Dr. Fickle for some time.
And how long did that go on?
I think that went on the better part of a year or so.
And before that?
Before Dr.
Well,
I'm not.
Okay, but one of the major changes is that we now have an administrator who administrates, and we have hired a separate chief medical officer.
Correct.
And that has made a big difference. Good job.
Thank you. RN hiring, I'm particularly proud to say this is a combination of the efforts of our nursing leadership, our human resources staff, and the transformation initiative, bringing a rapid process improvement much needed to our hiring process for RNs, that we've gone from having a 30% vacancy rate for mental health RNs to zero.
Wow.
We have all of our positions right now filled. And if you promise not to tell my CFO, we're even hiring a couple that we don't have positions for in order that we're prepared well for any vacancies we may have in the coming months. So we're very proud of that. And again, a lot of credit to nursing leadership, human resources, and our rapid process lean leader team for helping us get to that point.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
I remember in the Ways and Means Committee, and I remember when Senator Carter was the chair of the subcommittee, the testimony was that there was enough. If we used all the money that we had for overtime, we could hire the staff that we needed, if we could find them.
Right.
Did you? And you found them.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Morissette, and members of the committee, we found them. Yes. Yes. I believe it really was a dedicated effort to recruit better. I would like to think that our image is maybe changing out there as a place that's more desirable to work in, and certainly the allure of a new facility on the horizon is something not a lot of healthcare workers ever really get to experience, working in a brand new facility, and that's a purpose-built facility. So I think it's a combination of things, and even if the economy has been a significant portion of our good fortune, now that we have these people, our task is to keep them.
Are you still tracking overtime, though? Is that changing?
Yes, sure, we are. Now, the good news is what we've just talked about. The bad news is that our historic budget for RNs is still not what it ought to be, nor what it will need to be in our new facility with smaller units and a different configuration. So we still have the challenge ahead of us to continue hiring, and that's why when we have very qualified applicants, we're certainly going to do everything we can budgetarily to do that. But our RN agency use and the costs associated with agency RNs is significantly down. RN overtime is down. We're not having as much success with our mental health therapy techs. That's still a work in progress, and we work closely with SEIU and then all of our labor management groups to that end. But we're pleased with the progress we've been able to make. It makes a big difference. Our psychiatrist positions are virtually full at this point. 97% is essentially full. We have three candidates coming in the next couple of months, and we in fact had a bumper crop this summer by having eight psychiatrists join our organization just in the summer months. I would also point out that our relationship with OHSU has really been a fruitful relationship for us. Dr. Todd Eisenberg is our chief psychiatrist for the OHSU program, and Dr. Knight Richardson, who was mentioned earlier in this committee meeting, they have been extraordinary to work with, and we have a number of very talented OHSU contracted physicians who blend into our staff very effectively. And I think our total number of OHSU psychiatrists now is 10 or on the verge of 11. So out of a full medical staff that includes internists and primary care physicians in our clinic of about 40 physicians. The metabolic clinic I mentioned earlier, there was a point for the U.S. DOJ and an excellent one at that. This clinic, we now have a physician in charge of the metabolic clinic, dealing with all of the diagnoses or symptoms that you see listed there on the slide. And because of the potent nature of many of the pharmaceuticals that we use, we sometimes create a metabolic syndrome that is many of these different diagnoses or symptoms combined. We're very pleased. We also have an extraordinary clinical pharmacist on board now, too, Dr. Eby, and that metabolic clinic is off to a great start. I mentioned centralized treatment earlier. I have several slides on this point, and I'll try to be brief with these, and would be happy to provide any other information to you. But in the original planning of the state hospital, and Linda will probably touch on this in her replacement project report, we didn't envision this concept of centralized treatment, and nor did we envision the U.S. DOJ's expectations of 20 hours of active treatment every week for every one of our residents. The only way to achieve that in any sort of affordable fashion is to create a centralized treatment area, or treatment malls, as they're sometimes called, where we begin to simulate a more normal lifestyle for our residents. Instead of being ward-centric, or the wards that contain their residences being essentially their world, except for time outdoors daily, we will and have already begun to simulate this centralized treatment concept by having our residents get up in the morning and go through their routine, as we all do, and then leave the residential wards and go to this area of centralized treatment. Now, we're not able to provide this for every one of our residents yet, but the important point here is with the temporary malls that we've created with the replacement project, Ms. Hammond's help, we have begun to experience what life will be completely like inside our new facility, where all of our residents will rise in the morning and move to a treatment mall and spend their mornings at the treatment mall, have their meals at the treatment mall, and continue their treatment in small groups, large groups, and the treatment will be active treatment in those areas that relate very closely to the residents' treatment plan, helping them with leisure time skills. Many of our residents have very poor leisure time skills. Their community functioning skills, behavior management, temper management, whatever the groups might happen to be. And our curriculums will change in our treatment malls as we go. So centralized treatment is sort of like a collegiate atmosphere. You can get up in the dorm and go to class and come back to the dorm when it's the end of the day.
Roy, what percentage of the residents that you have right now do you think are going to go back to the community? Is that the purpose of the 20 hours a week to get people to go back to the community? But there's a, then let me reverse it. What percentage do you think will never go back to the community?
Well, be, Senator Morissette, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, it would be difficult for me to,
yeah.
If you'll permit me, just in a sort of a mental extrapolation, I would say the vast majority will, in fact, go back to the community, and it's important for us collectively to have that goal.
Yeah.
And it will be a significant minority who will not.
Okay.
And by that, I would say less than 10%. Who would not.
And if you may, if I may, while the ones who do not go back to the community, you want them to be as well as they can be while they're there. That's important, right? That's
exactly right.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
I touched on some of the points in the in this next centralized treatment slide about participating in treatment similar to their life beyond the hospital. And I also mentioned that we'll talk about practical kinds of skill building in the treatment malls, leisure skills building, and also very therapeutic, very targeted kinds of activities in the mall as well. The philosophy for the organization, but most particularly evident right now in the treatment malls, is this philosophy of recovery, and Senator Morissette just alluded to some of those principles just now. This next slide mentions that we didn't originally plan for centralized treatment. It's critically important that that change took place, that in fact was taking place just prior to my arrival here, and the bottom two bullet points speak to how the USDOJ has worked out agreements with other hospitals in situations similar to our own, where they have agreed to a 20-hour minimum. And we frankly very much believe that that's a minimum, that we can achieve more active treatment in a week than 20 hours per patient. It will require having a dedicated facility such as we are going to have by the end of 2011. And of course, the staff to do it, but we can achieve 20 hours, and we can in fact exceed that.
Can you tell me what does active treatment mean?
Active treatment is, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. Active treatment is easily linked and clearly linkable, if you will, to the treatment care plan for any given patient. Not everything we will do will, some will be just purely recreational activities. This doesn't have a direct link. But on the other hand, for some patients, there could be staff intervening and actively participating in some sort of a recreational activity and doing so in a manner that is linkable to their treatment plan. So with enough staff and enough treatment care planning, we can link a lot of the activities of our patients to the treatment care plan and thereby achieve active treatment goals.
And I'm wondering, is active treatment, are there small group?
Small group, large group, depending on attention spans and what folks can tolerate, as well as
and hands-on treatments. Activities.
Mm-hmm.
How about verbal discussions?
Yes.
Same?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Yeah. I think it would be useful to have a before and after comparison, before you came and after you came. What have you done differently, and what are the progress that you've made? I think that would be really interesting for us to see that.
Well, we can use my 21-month horizon, but the credit will go to many, many, many people.
Well, I understand that, but I mean, obviously we have turned a corner, and obviously we were in trouble with the feds, and, you know, things were not good, and we lacked staff, and we lacked a lot of things, and you've come in and made some changes, but it would be good to see kind of a progress report in terms of what changes have actually occurred and what you are looking for in the future. I think that would be really important for us.
Thank you, Senator. I'd be happy to provide that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. I have a quick question for you, Lee. Treatment, and this might be old information on my part. Often I think people have compared inpatient treatment modalities are completely different than outpatient, and maybe they're all one and the same, but what are you doing as people are getting ready to be discharged, I guess, to make sure that whatever they're getting treatment-wise in the hospital kind of carries over in the community. Does there need to be a continuity? My common sense says it should segue well and it should be continued in the community, but is that happening, and what are you doing? And this might be a question for the next panel more so than you.
The next presentation could, in fact, touch on that, but Mr. Berkobian, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to just briefly say we have a community transition team, psychologists, social workers, multidisciplinary team that focuses on patients who are ready to transition. Some of the members may also remember that we brought three additional peer support positions into the organization as peer bridgers during the last legislative session. And these are folks who are consumers, who are on staff and role modeling and particularly targeting our patients who are ready to transition to the community. So we have community outings. We always visit a facility one of our patients is to be transferred to for get acquainted, get acclimated. An overnight trip very frequently is the case there. So there are a number of things to try and ensure success with the transition to the community. Good question. This slide simply highlights what we've created in the way of these temporary malls that we're working within prior to moving to a new facility. Portland campus has been our longest running mall. That's been up and running for a little more than 2 years, I believe. Our transitional services mall is a very different curriculum on campus here in Salem, specifically for our patients who are ready to transition to the community, to Mr. Berkobian's question. And our geriatric or neuropsych program also has a separate dedicated mall. So you can see with our civilly committed population, most of whom are in Portland, with our transitioning principally forensic patients and the geriatric neuropsych patients, we have a very different complexion in the malls that we have now. Our 50 building residents have not had access to a mall, and I'm pleased to say, again with Ms. Hammond's help, that we will have a 50 building mall coming online in the middle of December at this point, and that will be our largest mall. Will serve a very large number of residents within the 50 building, and they all do operate within the recovery model. I feel like I'm going on very long here, so I'll hurry through these last two slides so we can get to Ms. Hammond.
Yeah, we're ahead of schedule, so.
Okay. Treatment care planning. This is extremely important and foundational to our ability to do our job well and to do it consistently throughout the organization. We are, again, in sort of a temporary fashion, utilizing an electronic master treatment care plan that we're beginning to roll out campus-wide. It's starting in our geriatric program. This will give us tremendous consistency in terms of how we treatment plan. It will be very apparent when some element of the treatment plan, say from psychology or from social work or from our recreational services staff, has not been placed in the treatment plan yet. We'll be able to know that. And very importantly, it's really the last bullet on this slide. It really helps us prepare for the behavioral health integration project, information project, BHIP as we call it. So we're just now rolling out this electronic master treatment care plan. Historically, we've done our treatment care planning essentially differently on almost every ward, different in some aspect, which does not lend itself to consistency, of course. Treatment plan, treatment team documentation, that was another transformation initiative, rapid process improvement, and another effort on our part to get the various members of the team really bought into the importance of timely documentation in the chart, and again preparing us for the BHIP project on the near horizon. trauma-informed care, or as we're calling it now, trauma response. I alluded to this in the introductory slide, and so I'll just touch on it again here. For too long, we have not really attended well to our own staff who have been traumatized physically or otherwise by the sometimes very challenging environment they work in. And this was a significant issue in labor management meetings when I first came to the organization, and I'm pleased that we've pleased to be able to say that we've now appointed a coordinator for that program, Patty Frazier, a member of our mental health specialist on our psychology staff, has assumed that role. We have just completed a needs assessment. We asked our staff what their needs were and what their expectations were and what their interests were in terms of participating in the response team as well. And we're preparing our staff through training at this point so that we can be much more attentive to our staff. So we're pleased that that's underway. Brief H1N1 update. We've provided seasonal vaccine to the majority of our staff and to our high-risk patients. H1N1 is coming in small supplies. We know that. We hear that. We read that everywhere. Members of this committee, I'm sure, will remember that the state hospital had great difficulty managing norovirus in the past and sometimes had significant organization-wide outbreaks. Our infection control employee health staff have really done an excellent job in the last year or so of managing our population better. We really have almost no isolation capability out there in the truest hospital sense. Our best opportunity is to cohort patients who are febrile or have respiratory symptoms, and to also cohort our staff and not circulate them around the organization as well. And our staffing patterns and our employee health and infection control efforts have gone very well. We've actually had a couple of quarantines already this season on our campus. They're now out of quarantine, and we're hoping, as many are, for more H1N1 every day. We have a small supply coming in next week, but my guess is because the supply of H1N1 vax has been slower in arriving than we would like, is we will begin to implement some visitor restrictions, visitors who are symptomatic and visitors who are 18 years or younger will probably be implementing some of those changes in the very near future. So that's the end of my report.
Just one quick question on the death that had happened at the Oregon State Hospital, and he had been in monitored for, it seems like, a long period of time. I think the latest I read about was that everything was on the up and up. But could you give a scenario on the particulars of that, of what you could at least share with us?
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'd be happy to do that. This, members of this committee appreciate as much or more than anyone that the right to health privacy doesn't end with an individual's death, and so there's much that I cannot comment on, but unfortunately the picture that people have of being unmonitored or unattended is somewhat of an inaccurate picture. On the other hand, it's also a somewhat accurate picture of the inactivity that we have in our organization and many of our wards on the weekends. Many of our residents prefer to just lounge all weekend and sometimes outright sleep through much of the weekend, sleep through meals. And such was the case with this individual who passed away in our 50 building. It was not at all uncommon for him to spend much of his time, especially weekends, alone and sleeping. I believe the public information the medical examiner with the state police came out with was an expected death in the range of noon to 2 that day. This individual had had breakfast, had had a complaint of a hip pain or some pain like that, but it was not chest-related or cardiac kind of pain. Took an oral medication for that. Slept through lunch. We did not serve lunch to this individual. His pattern was to, when he awoke, to go out and get his tray, bring it back to his room, and eat alone. He almost always did eat alone. And it was not uncommon on weekends for him to sleep through a meal, which he did at lunch. And later in the evening during a med pass was when they discovered that he was, in fact, had passed away and was not sleeping. I also want to point out that we do an internal M&M morbidity and mortality conference within our clinic staff on all patient deaths. And it's not uncommon for us to have as many as 5 or 6 deaths by natural causes and residents who go on the failing list, even in a quarter. And I think deaths in institutions are always a tragedy in and of themselves. But we not only have an M&M review internally, but in this case there was an Oregon State Police review for any kind of criminality or neglect, and it's my understanding that they felt there was none. And we're now in the middle of an OIT investigation for internal investigation with the Office of Investigations and Training for the same sort of thing, and that report's not back out yet. So
thank you.
Hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah.
I notice on Matt. Thank you. Junction City, on the very last slide, the last couple of pages, you address that, and you're in looking, there's wetland mitigation, there's all kinds of things. You haven't broken ground yet?
Ms. Hammond, we'll
okay, that, you're going to deal with that later. That's fine. I'll wait.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah,
thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Hammond, and I'm the administrator for the Oregon State Hospital Replacement Project. Our project continues to move forward. We're under construction in Salem with the 620-bed facility, and we are moving into the planning phase for our smaller facility in Junction City. We went through extensive programming for Salem, and we had recognized through working with the hospital how the design of the facilities need to be laid out to support the programming needs of the hospital. So the footprint for both of the facilities will be similar in as much as we will standardize the format for the residential units and the treatment units so that there is good continuity between the two campuses and that we are cognizant of being good stewards of state money, that we spent this time designing Salem and you don't want to throw that away and start again. You use that as much as you possibly can to move forward, understanding their different sites, but really needing to keep that continuity between the two facilities. And so treatment will look, as Roy has said, with housing units and treatment units, the facilities will have that common way of operating and the same access to the outside space. Guiding principles for construction of the new facility, the replacement project really recognized that as a facility, we're a collection of services in a continuum, that we are an important piece of how this population is served, but there is that need, as Roy has spoken about, for that continuity of when patients come in from the outside and go out again, that we do everything we can with facility design to emulate a healthy lifestyle and to emulate the ability to move back into the sort of environment that they've come from. So our main things that we think about are definitely to start with how we design and construct to ensure safety for everybody associated with the facility, the staff, the patients, the visitors, and the community who have been extremely involved in the Salem campus. And we really recognize that in Salem it is a unique campus, and it has a great deal of significance for historians, the connection to the Kirkbride, which I will speak to in a short while, the grounds, the park-like grounds that surround the hospital. You've heard me say this before, it's the Salem campus, but for many people it's the park that's in their front yard, and they have very strong feelings about it. And the surrounding neighbors and neighborhoods have been brought into this process and have been now moved from a position of fear to a position of partnership. And we have seen, and Mr. Orr can attest to this, we've seen significant interest from them to work with us to a solution-based process for everything that both we address now and in the future. The modern facility, what does it incorporate? Our job is, my job is bricks and mortar, and to leave behind a facility that works for the treatment that's needed. So we really look to a city within a city model. So we are in Salem, and we recognize we're an important piece of that community, but we also need to provide for our patients a really good environment, so that city environment where they can function and move around in a way that emulates that outside environment. It's been very clearly articulated that treatment for patients needs to be away from their residential areas, that the environment for patients and how they function and participate in their treatment is that they are given opportunities to participate in their own recovery, both through the treatment plans and through the design of the space, so that they, for example, can look out of a window and see a green space and have that ability to connect with that, to have that ability to have activities available to them so they can make healthy choices. And as we encourage them to do that and work with them to support to do that, it's important that the environment really has a feel to it that makes them want to do that, and we can do that through design. And that also you'll see and hope that you'll be able to take a tour with us. We will open our first piece late next year, and you'll be able to see the size of the treatment areas. And Roy has talked to the increase in staff, and that clinicians will have a much more manageable caseload and a much better environment to work with that caseload. Modern facility needs to incorporate many things as we move forward. We look at cost-saving energy management. We want to make sure we are designing an environment that is sensitive to being cost-effective. Modern heating and air conditioning. It's one of the things we heard from patients when we did our workshops with them. They wanted a good environment so they could be active. And the design that promotes safety and security. A lot of discussion, a lot of experts called in to ensure that as we look at not only the buildings and the green space, but how people need to operate in it. Our buildings are definitely a component to safety, but they're only as good as the people who can operate in them. So if our environment isn't designed in a way that they can be successful, then we've just added the same sort of barriers that we're facing now. So that's very important to us, and we've done a lot of work in that area. Same with well-lit open areas. We have 6 acres of internal green space, so secure within our perimeter. There are courtyards for each one of the areas that are accessible, both from the residential areas and from the treatment areas, as secure green space for the patients, and they are programmed, and patients will be participating in completing those green areas, planting them, having say in what we do within those areas to promote this access to fresh air. One of the important pieces of our new facility is the electronic medical record. As Roy has spoken to up to this point, they are using computers to a point where they'll use Excel or Word or email, but they really are exclusively a paper-based system for record keeping and for tracking of patient files. BHIP will implement the electronic medical record, and it will be HIPAA compliant and meet all the confidentiality requirements. But it also is very focused on achieving data management, risk management, quality. So it's about treatment plans, it's about medication, but it's also about providing information to folks such as yourselves who need to know how we're doing and need to be able to look to us to give you consistent information that can be backed up with good, solid data. So as we look at our systems, that's definitely a consideration for us. I'm following extensive review of proposals, and we had over 100 staff review the finalists that were the data systems. We had consultants who reviewed, and we went through an extensive contract review process. We're now in a place to enter into a contract with a service provider. The service provider is in 30 other states providing electronic medical record in the same type of environment that we have. They do a lot of community services too. They advise on the federal level and have they're a really good, solid organization for us to partner with. And they do provide an 80% out-of-the-box product. If we were staying with the ward-based system, it would be actually be a 95%, but because we're going to the centralized system of care, they are using their resources to help us develop that piece of the software, because it is new on the national radar for states to look at this. So yet again, Oregon is leading the way, but we're leading the way with an organization that is very well founded, very successful, and we believe the best partner for us in this area.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I've been waiting to hear the word stimulus money.
It can be used in the community, Madam Chair, Senator Monson. Yes, it can be used in the community component, but it can't be used within the hospital setting.
So you're not getting federal dollars?
The federal will not fund the hospital component, but we are already positioning to go for stimulus money with the community linkage piece, which we would be able to go after.
Good. Thank you.
This gives you an idea of the sort of training that we're doing. We do have staff who themselves, because we're not a computer-based system, are uncomfortable. So we're using our time right now to work with everybody, even on a one-to-one basis, to look at how we help people become successful with the new data system. And if that means going to the wards at 3:30 a.m. and working with a member of staff, that's what we do. We are really doing a lot of outreach to get people so they're comfortable and ready to work with the system when it comes on board. This really starts to tell us about where we're going. What you see on this slide is the image of the new facility that will be the Oregon State Hospital. As you can see, it is all in one place. It doesn't straddle Center Street anymore. It's all on the south of Center Street. It's contiguous. It is within one secure perimeter. It respects the past. You can see the image of the 1883 Kirkbride, you with the little girl on the swing there from when the staff used to live on site. That is an actual photograph from the early days, and that is the piece of the building that we are renovating at this time and keeping us, and will be an active part of the new facility. One of the pieces that you talked about how do we make people successful as they move to the community, and what are we doing to really open those doors for them and help them? The transitional cottages, which are the first beds that have been developed at the new facility, there's 6 cottages with 36 beds, and these are the final step down for patients as they return to the community. Not all patients will go through these, but the appropriate patients will be placed in these houses, and they actually take part in their own meal preparation and becoming a governance body within the house, and they learn how to take on those additional responsibilities and to move back into this environment. And these cottages actually opened up in February of 2009. You can see a picture there of some of the challenges we had during the winter time. We were stopped on construction for about a week last Christmas, if you remember. We had a little bit of snow.
Just a little. But
we did open the first one in January and completed in February, so we were able to move patients into these houses, and we have heard great comments from patients and from staff about the way they feel about the cottages. Comments from patients are they can look out the window and see the grounds, and they feel a lot more connected, a lot more revitalized and ready to really take on the next step in life.
Are they all cottages all on campus? Or?
Yes. Yeah. They are still part of the bed count for the facility, so they are still part of the hospital.
Madam Chair,
yes.
It would be interesting to hear when you give us an update on before and after, what happened before, how people were prepared, and what the result was as opposed to. So that would be an interesting thing to track.
One question,
yes.
Real quick. You said they're still part of the bed count. I know there's different funding for people living in outpatient, like small group, that these people, but that doesn't apply to this transition.
We tried, Madam Chair. we tried to do this, but because we're on the campus, they still receive their treatment in the hospital. They go to their treatment model in the hospital. It's still considered hospital beds, and but we did look for that opportunity. What you see here is the first component of the new facility that will be opened in the fall, around November of 2010. This is 144 beds, and this is the admissions, behavior, and corrections component of the new hospital. So this is the component where people are received into the facility, assessed, and then they would be, it would be determined where they would spend the majority of their time. They may possibly go to the behavior unit for a while if it's decided that they're not ready to join the general population. Also, if folks are having problems, if individuals are having problems in their residential unit or treatment units, staff could decide to send somebody to the behavior unit to stabilize and to remove them from that environment. This was a request from staff because it allows them to be more successful with these patients. It's less disruptive for the other patients, so it's very much a positive way of having people stabilized and then able to return back. And then we have 20 corrections beds, which are specific to the Department of Corrections. These folks never go into the hospital as such. They remain in these beds. They're medically stabilized, and then they return to the Department of Corrections. There you can see in the forefront also is the vocational rehab portion of the new facility, which will be twice the size of the vocational rehab area, which is where the patient work goes on. So this is where patient pay type of activities, where they're actually, and patients, again, this was driven by them. They want to work. They really want to do this. And so we heard from many patients how excited they were that not only would there be this function, but it would be expanded.
That's good.
Restoration of the Kirk Bride building. This is the 1883 component of the facility. Workers are right now, they're shoring up the building. We've done the internal components of the restoration. Now we're working on replacing the roof. It will complete this month. I'm glad to see a sunny day out there, believe me, because we've got a few things still we need to do. We'd like it to stop raining. And one of the most distinctive features of the Kirkbride sits right in the middle, and that's the cupola. That's that tall peak on the front of the building. We will actually take that off. We will lift it off and lower it to the ground to work on it and then put it back. And that's what we're supposed to do tomorrow if we don't have high winds. So, again, I'm really glad to see the weather out there. And that will allow us to finish up that roof. And then we're fully contained in the Kirkbride and we'll be able to do the internal finishes.
Okay. Madam Chair, when we have the 9.2 earthquake 50 miles off the Oregon coast, will that building withstand the shock in the valley?
This, Madam Chair, Senator Morris, yes, this building is being seismically upgraded throughout, and it will it meets all the highest level which is required within the state. Can I guarantee you it won't come down? I'm not that foolish. But I can guarantee you it will stand as well as the newest buildings within the state.
Okay, thank you.
One of the interesting components that I just wanted to put on the table today is the amount of change that the hospital is going through right now. We're asking the staff and working very closely with the staff to map out and plan for all the eventualities associated with several things that have competing deadlines, have overlapping activities, and have points of juncture that are critical for each phase of what we're doing. This includes the continuous improvement plan that the hospital has been working on for many years. We are phasing in the new building, so we will see components of the new building open early as 2010. The summer of 2010, we'll start and open the new kitchen, the new central utility plant, and we'll have some of the medical buildings completed. Then in the fall, we'll have the admissions, behavior, and corrections, and we need to move some people out of a building on the south side into that facility so we can take that component down. So we need to, they need to be able to operate in a secure way while they're still very closely linked to a construction site. And they'll be looking at, I think of it like a set of scales. In November, the scales start to tip. We're moving away from doing business in the old facility and in the old way to the new facility. And then by the middle of 2011, we open the next phase, which is the psychosocial rehab, which is your largest bed unit. And those scales start to measure out, level out, and you've got half the facility operating in an old environment and half this facility operating in a new environment. And then at the end of 2011, you balance out to being all your new environment. And those have so many complexities associated with them, everything from how we give out medication to how we physically clean, maintain, and secure a building when you've got this two types of operations going on. So it's a very challenging phase that we're going into. We're looking at asking them to learn how to provide services using a new service delivery model. And by the way, we're going to give you new software, and we're going to train you all on computers and add a few more staff while we're at it. And we'd also like you to plan Junction City at the same time. So we're asking them to not only fill their plate, but we're asking it possibly to overflow. So we're working very closely with the hospital to make sure that they have the resources necessary. And as a construction project, we support them and do everything we can on our side to make sure that they are successful. We are as successful as they are, and we know that partnership is very important, and we'll continue to work with that. Junction City, as I said, we begin the planning, and that's a corner of our site there that you can see. We are already working on that site. Department of Corrections is working with the city of Junction City on the off-site infrastructure that's going to be needed for us to actually build the facility there. And it is a preferred location for a bioenergy park, so they're working closely to ensure that as we design, we've got the biomass is being considered so that we can use modern technology to really make our project as green as possible. It also, it has wetlands issues. they say be careful of a gift. When we first went into this, we didn't think that there was that much wetlands on Junction City, and nor did Department of Corrections when they shared this with us. So we learned later, when we were required to do a different type of wetlands evaluation, that the majority of the site actually is considered to be wetlands. So we're doing some mitigation. We don't have old buildings. That's the good news. The bad news is we have wetlands. So there's always going to be something. So we're looking at drainage, we're looking at access, we're looking at the railroad tracks that run down both sides of the property, and how do we partner on there. But we're also generating some excitement in Junction City. They want to be our partner. They want the success of this project, and it's really good in the way that we're linking together and working with the Department of Corrections and Junction City on this. So they're excited about the job opportunities that are coming up. So one of the interesting things we've done to track what's happening in Salem is Hoffman has security cameras. Hoffman Construction is our general contractor for the project. And they have cameras installed, five of them, to monitor the hospitals for security of their materials. We actually enjoy it because we can see the progress that's made. These photographs are updated every 15 minutes. They're on our website, a link, and you can see, and you can run these photographs almost like time-lapse and see it go from day to day. There's 1,000 photographs at a time from each camera, and you can run them and see the progress on the site. Hoffman, tell me if I see a workman standing on two images, I need to call them, because he's been standing there for 15 minutes. So I don't know if that was a challenge, but I'm going to keep my eye open for that.
So your website is listed here?
Yes, our website is listed right there, and if you click on that website, you will get to our cameras, and these are the sorts of images you will see of our site as it moves through the construction phase. So this is looking out over the admissions, behavior, and corrections piece. We've just put the top level on this, and we'll start and enclose this now, and it will be fully enclosed by January, and then we'll be able to start on the internal work. Okay. And then this is the Kirkbride. The roof is going on that right now. That will be fully enclosed by approximately the second week of December, and then we'll be completing all the internal finishes on that. So there's our contact information. Should you have any questions, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Well, it is exciting to see this progressing as it is, and I'm sure the staff and patients will really benefit from it. Thank you very much. Any questions? All right. Thank
great.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'll close that informational hearing, and let's have Community Mental Health Services to present OASH admissions and serve discharge patients. That's Richard Harris.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, I'm Richard Harris, Assistant Director for Addictions and Mental Health and Department of Human Services. I have with me this morning Kevin Campbell, who is the Executive Director of the GOBI organization in Eastern and Oregon. We're both going to talk a little bit about how we structure the community mental health system to be able to get people from the state hospital, since we've had an orientation to the state hospital this morning, out into the community and independent and managing their own lives. So on page 2 of the presentation is an outline of what I would hope to cover this morning. I'll go first, and Kevin will add a perspective from the community about how this system is working and where we want it to go into the future. So I'll spend a little time talking about how the mental health system is structured just as a reference place. Then we'll talk some more about what some of the issues are.
We do have a document reader where you can actually put this on the screen if you'd like, or would you prefer just to work off the hard copy?
I think we can just work off the hard copy if that's okay with you.
Okay.
We ultimately want to spend most of the time talking about where we want to go and the steps we're taking to get there.
Just as clarification, though, for those who are listening to us or watching us, they will not be able to see this. Right. That's the only benefit.
Well, you could certainly put it up. That would be fine.
Okay. Once we turn on.
Yeah.
Maybe you can have a third person come up and just turn it for you while you're going through it.
Okay.
Well, looks like we have a volunteer here.
Mm-hmm.
You can just turn it over and...
Although we're now on the third page?
Yes, we're on page three. So this is Leah Kraft, who is a legislative coordinator for addictions and mental health. She's replaced Jane Ellen Wyvance. Jane Ellen has gone on to manage the integration projects that we're working on, which is we're going to touch on just a moment in this. So the way the mental health and addiction system is organized is that we work with our partners in each of the counties. We're a contracting entity that passes through federal and state funds. The services are provided by the counties or through the county subcontracting system to private nonprofit organizations that deliver services. There's a whole network of those services throughout the state that are connected through the counties. The counties have employed systems of MHOs or managed mental health organizations that actually manage most of the services through the other private service providers. And I think we have over 300 individual service providers around the state in this system. The mental health and addiction system has both residential programs and outpatient programs, service elements that cover everything from crisis to acute care in hospitals to residential treatment programs and to outpatient treatment programs as well. Now, this is the community side of the system. As you heard earlier from Superintendent Orr, there's a state hospital system that includes the campus in Salem, a campus in Portland, and Blue Mountain Recovery Center in Pendleton to provide the facility-based, hospital-based residential mental health treatment activities. So right now the total budget for all of the funds that are spent in the operation of mental health facilities is around $900 million a biennium. About a little more than half of that is spent in the community. The other half is spent in the state hospital system. If we go to the next page, this is a representational flow chart of roughly how people are moved through the system. On the left-hand side, you see the points of access for individuals who get referred into the community mental health programs and the contracted providers. and through MHOs and managed care organizations, many of those services are paid for through those entities. As you can see, there's a long list of community services that includes the state hospital facilities and the in residential facilities in every community. So if you go to the page 5, you'll see a chart here of the residential facilities capacity throughout the state. So we have adult foster homes, which may have one or two individuals. We have residential treatment homes that may have up to as many as 16, but generally are smaller, around 4 or 5 beds. Residential treatment facilities, secure residential treatment facilities, which have the capacity to hold people under the PSRB in a secure setting. So the two columns show the number of facilities and within those facilities the number of beds that are allocated to serving people under the Psychiatric Security Review Board. This is an important feature of our residential treatment programs in the community because when individuals are deemed to be able to be in the community, they're discharged from the state hospital PSRB program out into the community. It's an essential way for people to come back after a time in the state hospital. So all of these facilities and add up to about 1,600 to 1,700 beds for people outside of the state hospital where they may be referred back into the community. The whole idea here is that people benefit from treatment in the state hospital and then would continue their care into the community in some level of care, and these represent the various levels of care that we have built and constructed over time. In the days prior to the closure of Damish Hospital, we had many fewer beds. When we closed Damish State Hospital, the commitment was to create capacity in the community for people at all levels, and that's what these beds represent. One of the aspects of creating a system like this is that, in fact, what we've done is we've downsized from a state hospital to a much smaller types of facilities, and there are many benefits to that. They're in the communities where people were living and where their supports are, but also it's created some other issues around institutionalizing people for long periods of time in facilities that don't move people to full independence. So if you're in a facility, you don't have a key to the front door. You don't have the ability to manage your own life independently. And so it's a big step to move out of institutional care in state hospitals to the community this way, but we need to make further steps out into the community in appropriate facilities. So this next chart on page 6 is really showing how we spend money. So if you look at the residential and hospital portion of this chart, it shows we spend 58% of the funds that are available for mental health services on roughly 12% of the population. So we have the most expensive form of mental health treatment going to a smaller number of people. And I, for one, as well as others, have questioned whether we can continue to go in this direction and that do we need to be seeking alternatives that are less expensive to a fundamental residential model. So there are, as progress has been made by mental health services over the last 20 years of we've experienced the deinstitutionalization movement to a more community-based set of services that provides services to people where they live in their community. And the question for us is how do we sort of right-size this system? So part of the, if you go to the next slide, the concerns that we're focused on here, we have to make sure that in our mental health system that we've addressed these issues, that we make sure that we are dealing with the health disparities of people with mental illness, that we have appropriate lengths of stay in facilities, but the facilities are used when they're needed by people. Some people may need to be in a facility basically the rest of their life. Other people do not need to be in the facilities for extended periods of time. So it's a matter of adjusting the needs of our clients with the opportunities to get healthy in the community. So these are just a few of the areas of concern. So I want to go next to the length of stay, because I think this is a critical part to understand how our system needs to, what direction our system needs to move into. So these are numbers that have been accumulated over recent periods of time. They haven't changed a whole lot. They actually are fairly consistent. And that is at Oregon State Hospital. You can see actually it's a shorter length of stay there than it is in many of the residential programs we have in the community. So what we are doing right now is we're doing an analysis of this average length of stay. We're trying to determine what's the appropriate length of stay for individuals. So we're in the process now of contracting with a third party. We've done a preliminary study within AMH about how long people are staying in these programs, and we hope to now find out how people move from programs, one facility to another, and whether or not the diagnosis is consistent with the length of stay that they're having in some of these facilities. It's my belief that the length of stay is probably too long, and that in fact, if we manage our residential facilities more carefully, we could reduce the length of stay. Now, the consequence to that is that in fact, you can move people through the state hospital more rapidly because there are places for them to go without having to build new capacity. So realizing that we are in a place where the investments we're making in mental health are not likely to get a whole lot larger, that we have to be better at managing the system of care that we have. So what we're intending to do is establish what should be the length of stay. Then we have to figure out what the mechanism is to manage people so that they get their needs met and have the appropriate length of stay.
Yes. Senator Cruz?
Richard, could you, working in those numbers, could you carve out the quote-unquote permanent guests at the various places and see what that, because that would have a potentially a dramatic shift on the numbers. My sense is looking at the residential treatment facilities, the long term there are some that are truly long term.
When you look at Chair Moses Anderson, Representative Cruz, when we look more carefully at those numbers, I sort of hesitate to put these numbers up there because they're much more complicated behind it. So if you looked at the average length of stay, some individuals could have been there for 1,000 days, where other individuals may have been there for 2 months. So it's not an accurate depiction about what's going on, and that's why we're doing this more thorough study so that we can identify who are those individuals who need long-term care, because there are many that right. do, right. and who are those individuals who would benefit from a shorter care. But this is a general measurement And I think it's only illustrative. It isn't meant to be the actual picture of how people are utilizing. So it's really important for us to know this accurately, because we aren't about to make a commitment to just arbitrarily reduce the number of days people stay there. It ought to be based on what the needs of those individuals really are.
In very general terms, Madam Chair, there's kind of two populations we're dealing with, those that truly are long-term and then those that we're trying to transition back into society, and it's two different treatment modalities, and so we kind of got dual track. It'd be nice to be able to at some point differentiate those populations. But
that's absolutely correct, and that's really the purpose of doing this study. In short, I think that what we're trying to do is systematize the flow of individuals from the state hospital to the community and to the various services in the community. And to do that, I'm just going to skip forward to slide 10, if we could, because one of the issues in this process of moving people back to the community is that we streamline the process within the state hospital to the community, that connection. So it is a transformation initiative that AMH has launched. We've learned a lot about how this process works. As part of that transformation, we're members of the community system, the state hospital and AMH are working jointly to solve this problem. So on the left-hand side, you see lots of decision makers, many steps, lots of decision points. As we're going through and developing and streamlining the process, we are trying to narrow it down to fewer steps and to get people out into the community in a more rapid fashion. And that process is going forward as a transformation initiative. We believe that it has implications for how many people can go through the state hospital and out into the community. But even as good as that might system reform might be there, unless there are capacities in the community for supportive housing where individuals can have the opportunity to get services where they're living on a permanent basis, we won't be able to ultimately improve the efficiencies in us unless we have that capacity. So that's the next step, is under what capacity we have to have there. Kevin is going to address some of these issues in the real world in terms of the experience that Gobi has had and the direction they want to go in. I just do want to note, though, that we're also right now working on the streamlining the process of individuals under the PSRB jurisdiction in their going back to the community. And some of you may remember that we had Bob Repine working on this project in the summer. He's subsequently gone over to the Department of Energy, and AMH has contracted with former Marion County Sheriff Raul Ramirez to pick up where Bob left off, and we're moving along. Hopefully by the end of the year we'll have a set of recommendations that would engage PSRB, the state hospital, and the community service system in doing some of the similar things that are in this trend, the transformation project that's going on now, except on the PSRB side. So there may be 11 steps that were on the civil side. If you go over to PSRB, there are probably more steps that you have to get through to get somebody out of the hospital. So the next slide is about the next steps in this transformation study. As I pointed out, we're doing a utilization study. We're working on the process with the counties to figure out what's the best way to utilize this system. There's been kind of a breakthrough. Many of the managed or the mental health organizations have said we would like to take on this process of managing the more effectively the system of services for residential, and Kevin's going to talk about that. His organization is stepping forward and is going to move us into a new era about how to manage the capacity. So I think in the end, this is really about moving resources from more expensive residential to less expensive services that are supported in the community. It isn't about taking resources away from the state hospital and moving them outside. It's not about taking resources away from anybody. It's about moving them down the line as they follow people out into the community. And we hope that Kevin's proposal with his organization is going to move us there more rapidly. There's on 12, I'm going to skip over this. There are a lot of other things that AMH is doing that affect the better management of the residential capacity, but I think we don't have time to go into those. I do want to show you the slide on page 13, though, because I think this is an important one. With the Children's Mental Health Redesign Initiative of 5 years ago, it was clear that we needed to better utilize the residential system, and you can see what's happened to children's residential over this time is that we've reduced the length of stay by half or more, and there's actually fewer residential beds in the system now, and we're still meeting the same need as they were before. So my hope is that we have a similar outcome on the residential adult side and a similar effect in effective treatment for people with mental illness so that they will receive their treatment where they're living with the right-sizing the system.
Is there a waiting list for residential treatment services? Children's?
For children's?
No. Okay.
And well, just a sort of a side note to that, we're having to make adjustments in the children's residential service system because of the forensic youth that are now coming into the system, and that we're contemplating the possibility of separating the residential business into a forensic side and a civil side. And that's strictly a facilities management issue about how you get the best treatment for people that may be behavioral more than mental health and vice versa. But if there isn't a waiting list now.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Greater Oregon Behavioral Health. GOBE is headquartered in the Dalles. We are a managed care organization under the Oregon Health Plan. We provide or contract for services to about 43,000 Oregonians in 14 counties. Our counties are predominantly rural, and they do now include Douglas County. So we're not only in eastern Oregon, we're in Clatsop, Columbia, and Douglas County in western Oregon. GOBE was founded on the principle that we have two basic ways that we can spend our money. We can spend it on acute care, or we can spend it in outpatient services or community-based services. GOBE has been among the most successful mental health organizations in containing the costs of acute care since we were formed. About less than 5 cents of every dollar that we get of the Oregon Health Plan goes to purchase acute care, and 95 cents goes for community-based services or administration or money that's spent within the communities. That's good in comparison with other mental health organizations. And it's important to recognize that because acute care is really the gateway to long-term care or higher levels of care. It's only when people go through acute care to access the current long-term care system, ultimately to access the state hospital, and then ultimately to access the extended care management unit. The numbers that Richard presented about nearly 60% of the money going to serve 12% of the adult population, I think we could easily put a finer point on that and determine that there's a real disordinate amount of money going to 3 or 4% of the population. And this is exactly where we were in 2003 with the children's system. The mantra back then was 60% of the money was being spent on 6% of the kids. What has happened since 2005, October 1 of 2005, when the Children's Initiative was brought online, lengths of stay have gone down, utilization of beds has gone down, we're serving twice as many kids, and we've contained costs. The amount of money we're spending today is within 10% of what we were spending for the for this population of children in 2005. That, to me, is a success story as long as kids are getting better, and they are. And the way that they are, we're using a standardized tool to measure the need for level of intensity of treatment. We're statewide. We engage a team-type concept, wrapping services around children in their community, utilizing natural supports to the maximum extent possible. And we've developed resources throughout the state that are alternatives to institutional care. And most children do much better in a setting where there's one or two children in a home than in a larger institutional setting. The problem we're faced with right now is we're literally spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on individual children and in wraparound type services in the kids system. And when they turn 18, we go to a totally different system for adults. That makes no sense whatsoever to me. I reflect on the slide that showed 1,500 to 2,000 jobs with the opening of Junction City. 1,500 to 2,000 is more people than I have in three of my counties. So those are big numbers, and the question I ask is, where will we get the money to pay for those jobs? I'm very concerned about that. Gobi's belief, and we have the support of other MHOs in moving forward to evaluate what a system change could look like for the adult system, is that we really need to not reinvent the wheel, but do what's working in the children's system and step into a situation where the county of responsibility maintains responsibility as people move through the entire system, both financial and clinical responsibility. That discharge planning starts the day a person enters a state hospital and not after they've been there for a disproportionate amount of time. When people come out of the state hospital, if they went in as a Gobi member, they should come out as a Gobi member regardless of what county the next step of their treatment happens in. And a standardized tool should be used to determine the level of need. I believe we can. It's emergent that we move in this direction, because in looking at the numbers, and Richard's slide said that we have a system that's out of balance, if we add 1,500 to 2,000 jobs on the institutional side and we don't have new resources to pay for those jobs, it's going to move the system further out of balance. And in closing, I'd simply say that the magic of the kids system has been that we have long-term responsibility for the treatment and care of kids that mean a great deal to their home county. And yes, they do move about the state, but that treatment team at the home county is empowered and works with the family to always try to bring the children back to their home community and to always try to establish services that are more local in nature rather than shipping them around the state. I have a couple of handouts that just give you an example. Working in collaboration with the Eastern Oregon Human Services Consortium, the first one shows crisis beds. We have 9 crisis beds that we track on a daily basis that go out to each of our counties to let them know where there's alternatives to hospitalization. And if we can get people into a crisis or diversion bed earlier, It oftentimes preempts having to send them to an acute care facility, mm-hmm. and recognize for most of our counties the closest acute care facility is Bend or Portland. So that's having these beds in faraway places like Boardman or Pendleton or the Dalles is really, really important to the continuum of care. And then the other is a weekly report that we put out that tracks about 140 beds in Eastern Oregon in the residential treatment system and says where the vacancies are. And so that if a county does have a need for a person for that level of care, we can get those vacancies filled as quickly as possible. So from our perspective, we believe that 94% of members of the Oregon Health Plan are enrolled in managed care. We really need to focus on that last 6%, move them into a managed care environment, out of the fee-for-service environment, reinvest the money in the community, have the availability of not only Medicaid funds, but also general funds that are currently being spent on state hospitalization to be spent on community support services like supported housing, supported education, supported employment, which don't fit well under a Medicaid model to try to fund or to track. And from Gobi's perspective, we would prefer to be at risk for our entire population for the full spectrum of care, including state hospitalization and long-term care. Thank you.
There's always been controversy on even whether we should have Junction City facility. We should be forcing our putting our resources into community base first and then see if we need to have our second. So we know that argument quite well.
Chair Mona Sanderson, thank you for the observation. And it's probably not right to ask a guy from Eastern Oregon if we should build two major hospitals 50 miles apart.
Right. Yes, the argument is where the population is, but there's also the same needs. And I am a very strong proponent of the community-based model. And I think a lot of major treatment can be done in the community-based model versus in the institution. But thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the perspective. Questions, comments? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
And the last item on our agenda is our state, our healthcare acquired infections. And we have Jim Dameron and Sean Colma.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sean Colmer, Acting Deputy Administrator of the Office for Health Policy and Research, and with me is my partner in crime,
Jim Dameron, the Administrator of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. Good morning, folks.
So what we thought about doing today is not only talking about the recent stimulus money that we got through our partnership with Public Health, Patient Safety Commission, and OHPR, but also give you some information of work that OHPR has been involved in since about 2007 around healthcare-acquired infections. So as some of you may remember, in the 2007 legislative session, there was a healthcare-acquired infections reporting program that got put into the Office for Health Policy and Research. Since then, we have at the request of statute, developed an advisory committee to inform us on how to create a mandatory program for reporting both outcomes and process measures for a variety of healthcare facilities, hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers, nursing homes, dialysis centers, freestanding birthing centers. So over the last year and a half, we've created a mandatory program that, beginning in January 1 of this year, hospitals and almost all the hospitals in the state are currently reporting infection outcome information to our reporting program around three surgery site infections and one around bloodstream infections in ICUs. So we have started down the path that the feds are asking or suggesting that we go down anyway. So we've begun that process. Starting in January 1 of 2010, we will be expanding the scope of the reporting program to include more facilities. So we're going to be including outcomes and process measures for nursing homes and process measures around ambulatory surgery centers. So all in all, once January 1 of 2010 comes, we'll be getting information and data around healthcare-acquired infections from over 180 facilities in Oregon. Both outcome measures, so infection rates, and process measures, what they're doing that we know are best practices around how to prevent healthcare-acquired infections. So that's some of the work that we've been engaged in, and Jim helps co-chair our advisory committee, along with Dr. Woody English from the Providence Health System. And that's some of the work that has been a foundation with which the work that we're going to be partnering with the Patient Safety Commission and the Public Health Department around prevention efforts through the stimulus funding that Jim's going to talk about next.
Madam Chair, before I do so, I testified yesterday in front of the House Health Committee, and Representative Greenlick asked me the tweaky question of, was the mandatory reporting program moving fast enough? And I'm not sure that I answered that question as well as I would have liked, so I'm going to put it back out there, and I'll ask perhaps my colleague, Mr. Comer, to address that. But my take is that we started in 2007. The foundational work was done rather quickly. Hospitals signed up. They had to learn a new data system. They had to come into compliance. They had to share rights to data with the state. They did that pretty quickly. They were all trained to use this new tool, this new federal reporting tool that the state has latched onto as an efficient way to gather data. Sean's group put out administrative rules, defined a small but reasonable data set, and information started to flow into that system in January of 2009. So that feels like pretty good progress. We will be faced with the guts of the central idea. One of the central ideas of this reporting program is to create publicly available information at the facility level for consumers to see who's doing good, who's doing not good. That is supposed to start in next year. And we will be faced with the problem of, do we have sufficient data to do that in any detail? Because our data set is small and still growing, that is going to be a challenge, and we'll be faced with that. So for me, the good news is state got this up and running pretty quickly. Hospitals are on board reporting data. We need to grow. If we're going to have robust public reporting, we need now to grow the system, the data flowing into that system. And there is a just published blueprint on how we might do that. And so that will be the next topic of conversation for the advisory committee and for the state to ponder. How do we expand this? We have a blueprint. We'll spend the first part of 2010 talking about that blueprint.
I have concerns. Well, let's put it this way. A question, what kinds of infections are the hospitals reporting? All or just certain kinds?
Chairman Sanderson, just certain kinds. So within the CDC method that we're we've adopted, there are a surgery site infection module, and then you can select within that about 40 different procedures. As an example, we only track knee replacements because about 49 of our hospitals do knee replacements, and then coronary artery bypass graft surgeries. So those are the two surgeries we utilize in our reporting program. But there is, as Jim mentioned, there's a lot of other ones that we could and that other states have latched onto that we haven't done quite yet. So does that answer your question enough?
What are the most common infections in the hospitals?
Mm-hmm. Chair Motis Anderson, I think the way we recommended and started our program is look just at that. Almost every state that has a reporting program like this starts with the coronary artery bypass graft surgeries, not only because there's high infection rates, but the mortality and morbidity is tremendous and the cost is tremendous. Most other groups do something like a laminectomies, cesarean sections, hysterectomies, or a knee orthopedic procedure. So those are the kinds of procedures that most states deal with this kind of reporting program. Also along with that, we do bloodstream infection reporting in ICUs, and that's a very common infection within the hospital setting.
So all hospitals are reporting all
bloodstream infections in ICUs.
In ICUs.
So not sort of worldwide, correct.
Okay.
Does that answer your question or not?
Well, yes. I just feel that we somehow need to beef up our reporting mm-hmm. system, and I'm not sure what we can do, but when we had this 2 years, when we formed this 2 years mm-hmm. ago, my idea was that the hospitals would come forward to report and then work together to find solutions to cut down, and right now we don't have to cut down the infections, mm-hmm. and right now it doesn't seem like we have the data to see has this process really decreased infection rates in the hospitals, because that was the goal. Why mm-hmm. have an entity if it isn't making a difference in infections in the hospital?
And Chairman Sanderson, I think that's where the advisory committee and what Jim was speaking to earlier is at that point, is if we're going to be moving the meter and attempting to move the meter around prevention and reducing infections, we're going to need more information in order to show those changes and show the good work that hospitals are either already doing or want to be doing. And we've built it on a platform that allows us to expand fairly quickly if we want to.
Okay.
Thank you. At least I've heard in the past, the VA hospitals tend to be exceptionally good at infection control. You might confirm or refute that. And if so, I guess the logical, why don't we just try to integrate some of those same types of precautions into other hospitals?
Madam Chair, Committee Administrator Berkovian, I think this touches on or speaks to the heart of this federal stimulus grant that we just got. And if I may, allow me to elaborate a little bit on that as a way to at least partially answer your question. In September, the Oregon Health Policy and Research, the State Public Health Division, and the Oregon Patient Safety Commission won a federal stimulus grant for $724,000 over 2 years to work with hospitals to reduce healthcare acquired infections over the next 2 years. And to my taste, this plan makes a whole lot of sense. The fact that we have three different kinds of organizations coming together to work in partnership with the hospitals is important. And let me quickly try to sketch out each of the roles of those three organizations. First, Sean's group, OHPR, is going to create a statewide plan that says we need to focus our attention on the most important infections. We all agree this is a serious problem. It's probably getting worse. We're all worried about antibiotic-resistant organisms. The prevalence of such things are going up. We need to work harder. So they are creating a statewide plan that says, here are the things that we need to align behind. Our starting point is the feds have done a pretty good job of saying, here's a short list of things we, the feds, say are important. Five or six areas they believe the literature shows we need to work on. We're starting with that list. We're going to put together, or working to put together, this plan that says, of those, where do we want to put our attention? If we can't do everything, where do we start? Or where do we continue based on where we've already started? So that's critical. They've hired a person to manage that project. They will also better use and make the data that we're collecting from that reporting program. We have to create a statewide plan, use the reporting program as both a means to monitor our progress, and also use the plan to expand that reporting program. I talked about a blueprint for the next iteration of the reporting program. The statewide plan will inform how we do that. The statewide plan will be in line with what the feds are thinking and what other experts are thinking. So that's their role. Public Health Division is going to work to ensure that the data that come into that system are useful. They're going to validate that data. They're going to independently check this, look at hospital charts and saying, you said X infections. Let's see if those numbers can be validated. So we're creating a tool. It's a new tool. It's a reasonable and important step to say how good is the information that's flowing into that data system. So that's what they will do. They will also help to measure our progress over the next couple of years using that tool. Validate the data, measure progress. The Patient Safety Commission is going to do the work directly with hospitals to see if we can lower infection rates in certain target areas. So we've committed to bringing together at least 10 hospitals, and I hope more, to reduce infections in the state 10% per year over the next 2 years. That's our job. We'll use a collaborative process. We'll create an advisory committee. We'll work closely in partnership with hospitals that agree to participate, and we'll monitor our progress over the next 2 years. Statewide plan, validate the data, work directly with the delivery system to lower healthcare-acquired infections. And to me, it and the backbone is this reporting program.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
Has anybody bothered to check with the VA to see what they're doing?
Yes. So, Chair Mines Anderson, Senator Morissette. Yes, we are using many of the same tools, and they will be part of our advisory group.
Okay.
So I lost sight. I sort of big picture lost sight of the specific question. So the short answer is yes. I should have said that a long time ago. They are doing good work, in my opinion. There is, to me, the context here is there's lots of good work being done in lots of places. Hospitals are doing some interesting work. There's lots of national standards. The VA has standards. There's lots of packages out there on how to improve, to reduce surgical site infections and urinary tract infections and central line infections, and hospitals episodically, independently, are putting some of those pieces in place. What's interesting, and I think ultimately will be useful about this grant, is an attempt to knit all that together, to say we as a state are buying into these things. We as a state are saying these are important. Here is a collaborative process to jointly work on these efforts. And we'll see. So for you folks, at the very least, you can ask, come January, where's the statewide plan? Come January, what's that advisory committee look like? Come April of next year, how many hospitals are in the collaborative? What's your change package? What efforts are you working on? Come the end of next year, did you lower infection rates by 10%? And did you validate all those data? Simple questions you can ask based on what we are doing over the next 2 years.
It just seems to me that it has to be a grassroots in at each hospital. I mean, yes, we have a statewide plan, but I think we need to know what is the hospital strategic plan to decrease infections in their particular hospital. Hospitals can report, but until we know that hospitals actually have a plan within their own facility to decrease, I mean, that's sort of the information I'd like to have, because I'm sure that hospitals have, and I see hospital representatives in the back, they must have some kind of plan to decrease, and I would like to, you know, maybe the hospitals don't want to report their individual infection rates and then how it's decreased, but to me, if they each had their own plan and then were able to decrease their own infection rate and then share what methods they use to decrease their infection rates, to me that seems part of what we need to be doing.
Let me add something to that. Just ask the hospitals what their best practices are. Every hospital should have best practices in. Say, what are they?
Mm-hmm. Chair Marnie Anderson, Senator Morissette, I agree. Hospitals are doing good work, and perhaps you should have them come up and tell you about that good work. A collaborative approach is meant to build on that good work. having a statewide plan isn't meant to say local effort isn't important. It's just to say that at some level it would be, I believe it would be useful to say that there's some aligning here. Hospitals, in my experience, are asking for some kind of alignment. Which things are we working on? They're pulled in so many directions. Their plates are so full. A plan like this can help simplify efforts, can help align efforts. And a collaborative approach is meant to build on the variation and the differential experience, if that means anything, amongst hospitals. One hospital is doing this to improve, another hospital is doing that. A collaborative becomes a safe place to talk about that stuff. So I think that, in my vision, you do both. You try to create and stimulate grassroots activity. You try to do it in a way that folks can share information across hospitals, but you do it in a way that simplifies the task by saying, we agree up front that we're going to work on a short list of important things.
Well,
and the Patient Safety Commission is going to support that work by staffing that collaborative, by helping to bring hospitals to the same table.
Well, I just want you to know I have a frustration with how data is coming from regarding healthcare infection rates. And so the next time I think that we have a report, I really would like maybe the hospitals, someone from the hospitals to report exactly what they are doing, you know, give examples of what they are doing in trying to combat healthcare infection rates. And if they're concerned regarding proprietary reasons why certain hospitals don't want their infection rates to be out there, I still would like the hospitals to come forward to share overall, broadly, what they are doing to try to combat that, because I think that's where we really...
Well, Madam Chair, I think that the list of what they're doing is impressive, and yeah, it's impressive. They're doing good stuff. But it's still a huge amount of variation, still lots of room for improvement, and still, to my taste, leaves the question, how do we help align those efforts? How do organizations like the Patient Safety Commission support the good work that's already being done out there? And we see, independent of the reporting program, we see, the Patient Safety Commission sees that a collaborative approach, bringing hospitals together in a consensual way has merit, and the hospitals that we have talked to seem to agree, and many have said they would like to be part of that. But a question you can ask us come next spring: who signed up? What are they doing?
Well, I think rather than just having you as a spokesperson, I'd like to have someone from the quality infection group too, from the various hospitals,
sure,
to come.
Sure,
talk,
sure. I'm just representing the commission
point of view
on this.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions?
No.
All right. Thank you, everybody. I really appreciate the information that we got today. It's very, very helpful. And with that, we're adjourned.